Hello and welcome to the Crate and Crowbar. It's the 7th of June, this is episode 144, and I'm Tom Francis. Here with me today are...
Tom Senior.
And...
Chris Thurston.
And the news this week is probably that E3 is coming up.
And next week.
Yeah. And stuff has already started to trickle out a little bit, like Watch Dogs 2, there's a screenshot going around of an advert for that that seems pretty convincing, and it suggests that it's not Aiden Pierce this time and that it's in San Francisco. Anything else you guys have heard about or excited about?
There's some stuff we know about. So we know that Titanfall 2 has been announced and will surely be at E3.
Yep, this is extremely likely.
Absolutely. And what else do EA have? They've got...
Mass Effect.
Of course.
This will be the... Yeah. I will eat my... Like...
Normandy statue?
Yeah. I'll eat your previous... the thing I nicked from you when you left PC Gamer, the 1/270 scale metal Normandy model. I'll literally eat it if Mass Effect Andromeda isn't in the E3 show in some way or another.
I'll feel partly responsible for your death.
If I die, that is how I was always supposed to die.
There'll be a lot of people like, oh, how did he die? Oh, that figures.
Yeah. It wasn't because Tom Francis made a renegade choice when he shouldn't have in an earlier episode of his life, and then Chris Thurston ended up dying for it.
Yeah.
But, you know, either way, it'd be a fitting death.
Yeah, indeed.
But this is really exciting because this is hopefully going to be a BioWare game built on the Frostbite engine. Of course, they've had Inquisition, but yeah. A sci-fi game in the Frostbite engine. And not just that, a Mass Effect game in the Frostbite engine about visiting alien planets. I'm so excited about that prospect.
Yeah, it's great. I have a pet theory that is completely unsubstantiated. Mm. But I wonder if they are going to do a remaster of either the first game... Or the like, or the even if it was just like a Nathan Drake collection type repackaging of the original games, because there's a lot of precedent for that in the industry at the moment. And actually, it's been longer than you probably think since there was a Mass Effect game. Like, by the time Andromeda comes out, it'll be 5 years, which will then also be the 10-year anniversary of the series, which is kind of nuts when you think about it. Yeah. But that means that, you know, there's... I mean, obviously, there's a huge amount of buzz around it, and maybe the fan community means that it has remained in the public collective memory for long enough that you don't need to do a refresher. But, you know, it's conspicuous that it is absent from the next gen of consoles.
Yeah.
And that it hasn't really had a showing for a long time. And I'd love them. I really want the excuse to replay everything.
Yeah, same here.
And
with all the DLC as well.
Yeah, with all the DLC. Like, and it now feels like the right time for the I miss this first time around box set where you know, treat it like three seasons of a TV show and you just play through this big spectacular thing.
I would love for them to like just sort of take Mass Effect 3's combat and put it into Mass Effect 1.
Yeah.
that would be so good.
Like a remake of Mass Effect 1 with Mass Effect 3's combat.
That'd be sweet.
As part of a big box set with the other two. I'd buy that.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I really, really would buy that.
I really, like, every now and then, you know, thinking about old games you want to replay, I sort of fantasize about just taking like a week or something and completely losing myself on something. And most games I don't really want to play for like huge long periods of time, but Mass Effect, I kind of do. Because A, it's got the RPG thing of like, you've got loads of different things ticking over all at once. You've got all these little side quests you want to clear up and you're excited about the next ability you're going to unlock, and also you're invested in the characters and all that stuff. And also it's just got this pace thing of like always returning to your ship and then having this kind of hangout time where it's you've got this home base and it's a fucking spaceship, so it's exciting. And I think I probably got less tired of Mass Effect than almost any other game.
Hmm. Yeah, like, I mean, it still will remain, I think, my favorite game series of all time. And it's weird, like, I should be really excited about the next one, but in a way it's just sort of like... It's a sort of treat thing that's on the horizon that might turn out to be amazing, and if so, great. And if it doesn't, it doesn't really damage my... But that's why, weirdly, like, everyone's like, Andromeda will definitely be at E3. But the thing I'm excited about is them just releasing the old ones again so that I can play them again, even though I could play them again right now if I wanted to.
I think it's because the new one is such... they've released so little detail about it. And with the old games, there was always that sense of Shepard and Shepard's journey and what you're going to get to be as Shepard next. And that doesn't exist at all for Andromeda yet. And once they've kind of established the fantasy of it, I think as soon as that happens, and if I'm into it, I will be madly excited about it.
Yeah, for sure.
Probably be as fanatical about it as I would for Mass Effect 4.
I remember like Mass Effect before release. It was kind of weird to think about now, but like the style of the armor in that game was actually really kind of weird and unusual for, like, compared to, like, Space Marines Gears of War and kind of and Master Chief. Like, they're all kind of sleek and angular and military and tough looking, and then Mass Effect is all, like, kind of bulgy and, like, they have quite big heads compared to the bodies and stuff when they're in the, like, space mode.
And they look like wetsuits as well.
And it's something slightly retro sci-fi about it, but, like, you know, 50s visions of space. And at the, like, I only remember thinking that at, like, looking at previews of Mass Effect and thinking, oh, this is a weird looking space game. And then now it's so ingrained in my consciousness that that's just, like, the default space armor.
Yeah. And also, over the course of the series, it got a bit more traditionally space marine-y and a bit, you know, sort of chunkier. And it learned loads from Gears of War about the combat, so that it was a much more obvious touchstone there.
You always had that choice. You could have your kind of sleek sniper who was in this almost, like, gleaming wetsuit, or you could be the kind of Vanguard with... was it Vanguard? What was the charge move?
Vanguard.
Yeah, that was great. And you'd have to bulk up and... But there with a shotgun.
But even stuff like in the first game, you dressed everybody on the squad. Mm. So, and there was, like, one best suit of armor, which was, like, the one that was, like, a black wetsuit with a salmon pink red stripe down one side. And that was, like, the best armor at late game, really. Unless you were playing on a lower difficulty setting, so you could wear whatever you like. Mm. And so everybody would be dressed in the same slightly goofy wetsuit, apart from Krogans and whatever. But... Master 1 definitely had a goofier kind of look to it. And also because the Geth are kind of goofy looking as well. They're kind of like weird, kind of lizardy, sinewy, you know, reptile robot monsters.
Yeah.
And then all the later games, I think, to their credit in some ways, and maybe it's a bit of a shame, became much more traditional TV sci-fi look, and everyone has kind of, like, to bring it back to Watch Dogs, an iconic hat of some kind. Like, everyone in the later, because then you can only dress people up as themselves, really, and, you know, you can't really customize them beyond, well, I'm loyal to you now, so now I wear my iconic hat with gold trim.
Yeah. You've unlocked my special suits I'll wear just for you.
That's how it works, you know, loyalty is
where friendship works.
I love to see, I can't wait to see new alien designs. I loved the design of Mordin, for example, that flat face, the big eyes, and the way that they made that seems so human at the same time, and the same for the Krogan as well. The way they kind of managed to create human expressions out of these giant frog monsters was.
I'm interested to find out what kind of story they want to tell with that, because, you know, so for example, if they announce Dragon Age 4, I kind of have a sense of what that will be, because Dragon Age is one continuous story with multiple protagonists that has branched and gone lots of different directions, and if there's a new one, it will just continue that story. Whereas Mass Effect ended. And whether you liked that ending or didn't, it ended in a big way.
Yeah.
And I know they're doing, you know, off to a new galaxy to see new things, but that means fundamentally that the story kind of needs to be something a bit different. It can't be like, oh, well, in Galaxy 2, there's this ancient force of machines that comes in Harvest's life, but in this galaxy, they look like wasps rather than lobsters. You know, it's... I don't know, it's interesting to see where they take it, because the original Mass Effect series felt like such a comprehensive cross-section of that universe and all the sci-fi ideas that were in it, to the point that it's sort of absurd that one person experiences and resolves every major conflict in the history of civilization.
Hooray for RPGs.
In this series, over the course of about 3 years.
Yeah, it's really interesting what they've said about it so far. It makes it sound almost like an imperialist thing, where you're actually going out there looking for a new home, and you're going to butt alien races off their worlds to do it, perhaps. And maybe that would be the central kind of moral tension of the new game, where, like, to what extent do you unseat? Yeah, if we're dicks and we want a new place, who are we going to actually throw out on? How are we going to force ourselves into this new community? And that sounds like a thing that BioWare would have a great time tackling and do a very good job of. So that's total speculation. Who knows?
Who knows? I mean, but as I say, I will eat a plastic spaceship that will almost certainly kill me if Andromeda isn't in E3, in EA's E3 presence in some way.
It's gotta be.
Well, I'm looking forward to E3. I really like watching like the big conferences and just watching, like, what they've decided are the, you know, 12 most important things and then mocking them.
I really enjoy it. Like, it's, I mean, people get really cynical about it, and I kind of sad that I've never been and may never go now that my focus is on esports. Because, Tom, you'll be there in person.
For my first time next week, I will be there, yeah.
Yeah. But, like, I mean, I think I said this last year, but it is the games industry's Eurovision Song Contest.
Yeah.
And for exactly the same reason that it's fun to stay up and watch the Eurovision Song Contest, it's fun to stay up and watch E3, because, you know, you can be, you know, just be snarky about people's earnest attempts to please you.
It's an interesting one to cover as the press, because if you're sitting in a conference, you're actually far, you're very poorly equipped to actually cover the conference.
Yeah.
Because everyone at home is far, you know, they're just on the, in the CMS already can do those stories. So there's, but nonetheless, like I'm going to the, I think I'm going to the Xbox one, the Microsoft one. And I just want to have done a conference just to experience what it's like and what those ridiculous, you know, pronouncements are like in first person.
Yeah. The weirdest thing, I went 1 year and the weirdest thing was just like being near the people who whoop at the announcements, of exclusivity and things. And I'm just thinking, who the fuck are you?
Interview a whooper. See if you can find
Who paid you to whoop?
I mean,
did anyone pay you?
Are you an independent whooper?
Yeah.
Can you imagine if you're chasing them through the hall, but it's like one of those episodes of the X-Files where like Mulder catches a glance of the government operative that's been sort of shadowing him and he's like chasing him through the corridors and he vanishes around a corner and he was gone. Who were you,
E3
conference whooper?
Yeah.
Secret branch of the government that just whoops E3 conference.
It's gonna be exciting to do it.
Yeah, there'll also be some, you know, legitimately exciting stuff.
Mm.
Like I always look forward to like the new things that just came out of nowhere. Like I think, was it last year that Horizon Zero Dawn kind of appeared, and they just released a new trailer for that. That's PS4 only, unfortunately, but stuff like that kind of comes out of nowhere.
Yeah,
I'm really excited to see Ghost Recon Wildlands.
Yeah, it's been ages since we heard anything of that.
It has, and they showed an incredibly ambitious trailer last year, which you know, doesn't necessarily mean the final thing will be anything, but the idea of a kind of 4-player dedicated like co-op open world Far Cry, but with proper current gen.
Just Cause seems like another good touchstone for it as well.
Definitely.
Like serious, not Tom Clancy's Just Cause.
Yeah. And that is such a fun idea, and I can't wait to see if you know, they will deliver on that promise.
Mm. Yeah, they showed like a sort of video where they planned out their assault and like had a sort of sequence of events they were going to do, and then they execute it, and I think, I can't remember if it goes wrong or goes right, but then they sort of rewind and they show a different plan that you could have done, and that stuff appeals to me, obviously.
Yeah, definitely. Titanfall 2 will be there. I guess it will be playable if it's.
I imagine it must start this year, so it must be. Yeah. I imagine the same will be true for Battlefield 1.
Oh, yeah,
I think those will be the three pillars of
EA's
thing. It'll be Battlefield 1, Titanfall 2, Mass Effect Andromeda, or I'm Going to Die, and some kind of Plants vs. Zombies extended bit that no one knows what's going on during.
I'm going to the EA Play Lounge, I think, so hopefully all the playable stuff will actually be able to play. I'm really, really interested to play Battlefield 1 and Titanfall 2, especially because they're releasing so close to each other later this year. And so they're going to be very different flavours. It feels like that Battlefield 1 might be the flavour, the hardcore shooter flavour, and Titanfall 2 might be the super happy Battlefront player flavour.
I hope not, because Titanfall 1 had legit chops as a competitive shooter.
Yeah, it did, yeah.
Rest in peace.
Very, very exciting.
Yeah. I think, what other shows are there? So, yeah.
Got Ubisoft. Nintendo probably announced TZNX thing, which is obviously not PC gaming.
Sony. I wonder if there'll be anything of interest to the PC on the Sony conference.
Interesting.
Probably not.
No, The Last Guardian will surely show up.
Hmm.
There'll be a PC gamer show, right?
We're doing one.
That show we're doing.
That thing we spent.
Might not have been if I hadn't mentioned it.
Yeah. Of course, the PC gaming show, of course, return in force in a new refined format. And
does that mean it won't be 3 hours long?
It won't be 3 hours long. It will be much shorter and hopefully much kind of pacier and full of announcements and exciting things.
But still with the same sensibility.
Hopefully. We want to kind of get people, you know, show like indie games as well as big AAA stuff. You know?
Yeah, and a bit more of a relaxed setting as well.
Yeah.
Not an awkward panto
hopefully.
Sort of thing.
Hopefully.
Will it be day 9 again?
Sorry?
Day 9 again?
Do
you know?
Well, wait and
maybe
see.
Okay.
What happens next week at the PC Gaming Show?
At E3.
At E3.
You can find out more
I don't think we can say it's at E3, actually.
Can we not? I thought it was called the PC Gaming Show at E3.
You have to be careful about that stuff.
PC Gaming Show
I didn't say
in
that.
LA around that time.
Yes. It happens to be in the same city, in the same time zone.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Okay. Fine. A PC Gaming Show.
PC
Perhaps.
Games. We'll be there, definitely.
Convenient to go to if you're also going to EA, E3, and an affiliated Games Expo.
Correct.
Excellent.
Much better.
What have you guys been playing?
Oh my goodness. That's a good question. I mean, it's
not a question we've really ever struggled to answer before in the 144 times we've done this.
I've been obsessively playing UFC 2, but it's not a PC gamer as much as I wish it was.
I played Uncharted 4, that's not a PC game.
I spent 3 days pushing plastic spaceships around in Birmingham, and that definitely isn't a PC game.
But you can play it on PC via various tools.
Via tabletop simulator, yeah, and a browser-based thing, and a piece of board game software called Vassal. I suppose I could explain briefly the way that maybe changed the way I felt about competitive video games.
Yeah, sure.
I think that's tangentially relevant enough for me to talk about plastic spaceships.
Let's do it.
All right, so this is, if you are not aware, the X-Wing miniatures game, which is now apparently the most popular miniatures game in the world, having taken over from Warhammer.
It's a meteoric rise, only in the last couple of years, right?
Yeah, it's kind of a crazy story because Fantasy Flight Games, who also make Netrunner, which I imagine is probably... I'm going to guess there's a decent crossover between people who like Netrunner and people who listen to this podcast. They acquired the Star Wars license at a time when... So I heard the story from Quentin Smith, actually, and it's kind of like... Because Fantasy Flight have grown and grown and grown. But they've grown off the back of two really forward-looking but accidental acquisitions. One was like a decade ago where they needed something to kind of... They wanted to do, a fantasy card game. And they're like, what do we do a fantasy card game here? We need to go... Blah, blah. And I think the CEO shows up and says, I've just read this book. It's really good. It's called Song of Ice and Fire, something, something. And so they get the Game of Thrones license and then make the Game of Thrones trading card game, sorry, board game first, and now the trading card game. And now Game of Thrones is reasonably popular. And they picked up the Star Wars license while Star Wars was complete shit that no one wanted. And now Star Wars is owned by Disney and is massive, and the new movie has kind of pushed the miniatures game to enormous heights. But it's also a legitimately great game. Like, it's not... I was drawn to it for the plastic versions of spaceships that I owned in Star Wars Galaxies. And I stuck around and have ended up joining loads of clubs and playing it pretty seriously, just because it's a brilliant combination of turn-based board strategy, but with but also with a kind of rhythm that's more like something like Go is a good comparison than like another board game or like a more like a tabletop tactical game, simply because spaceships can't stop moving, so it's all about relative positions. But there's a heavy analog distance judging element, which is probably what separates it from most computer games. Like, you're not allowed to measure the movements you are locking into place for your ships, so you have to know what they look like in your head. It's all about kind of mind's eye sense of what a three bank left looks like into a barrel roll and where that'll put you relative to your opponent and all this stuff. And it's kind of crazy bearing maths. It took me until this morning to recover from this weekend in a way that sounds dumb. Obviously, part of that is just having been stood playing X-Wing for about 18 hours over the course of Friday and Saturday and Sunday morning. And the other part of it is it felt like I had overridden the firmware of my brain with some kind of fucking dodgy ROM that was just designed to set maneuvers for small plastic spaceships. And then Sunday and Monday were spent going through FAQ, trying to figure out how to clean and install the fucking thing, because I'd like broken my basic like operating system in some way. Like literally closing my eyes and seeing maneuver dials for spaceships. Like trying to go to sleep by thinking about anything else, but in any other memory, some concept from X-Wing would have been imposed on it. So if I was thinking about emails would move up and down according to the movements of X-Wing spaceships. Like genuine edge of madness, like overexposure thing. But the reason, I'm really enjoying watching Dota this week, and I won't talk about it too much. There's a big tournament on, and I really enjoy following the game, and I still play the game, and I'm really enjoying playing Overwatch, which I imagine we might talk about as well, pretty competitively. But I think I have arrived at a point in my life where I'm no longer that interested in playing these things competitively. And obviously, I've tried that with Dota teams and stuff, and played in in-house Dota leagues, and I'm very competitive, but I also like structured competition. You want to find an avenue for that. But really, what a computer game offers is the ability to compete essentially against yourself, unless you are the best of the best. Because if you have a rating, they're going to announce Overwatch's ranked format soon. And I imagine I'll get excited about that. But really, it's about this personal sense of achievement of like, I got to Legend or whatever, or I got to this in Hearthstone, or I got to this in Dota. But realistically, only a percentage of a percentage of a percentage of players ever really get to experience meaningful competition within these things at a scale where you can say I'm pretty good at this relative to other people, whatever. And as a result, after a couple of years of playing Dota seriously, it's like I'll still play it, but it would be mad for me to think that that's ever going to be anything other than a fun game I play. Whereas with miniatures stuff, I have found the benefit of playing something with a smaller community where you can compete at a like a national level. Like, this was a national thing over the weekend. I came 79th out of 400 odd people, which is all right. I'll take top 20%. Like, I could have been higher, but didn't go quite my way right at the end. But that's absolutely fine. I had a brilliant time. And I'm surrounded by people who also play and take it seriously. And it creates a much stronger sense of community. And this probably sounds really stupid if you play like a sport competitively, like in real life, if you go to a club and practice and go out and do things, even if it's just at a local level or a regional level. But it's something that I think games have actually pretty roundly failed to capture that I had forgotten or had missed until, like, I guess between university, when I had university sport, and now. I had missed what it feels like to actually compete in a way where your victories mean something. You're surrounded by people who you can talk about this stuff with and who you can practice with and so on, and that to be meaningful. Because for as competitive as games can be, and as huge as a pool of people that they can give you access to, it is quite an anonymous experience. Like, you have you and your friends playing a game in this massive sea of people, and nothing you do and it will really make a dent in most of it. If you work your way up to 5k MMR, which would be very respectable in Dota, you're probably still like at 3,000 hours from being even a bad pro player. Like, the I think as a competitive person, I had definitely missed, like, actually being able to A, achieve something, and B, like, experience that with other people. The other side of it, which is like, and so I guess that's if there was a game design thing here, it's like, question one, how do video games get to that point? Like, I've argued for a long time that games should have the facility to run tournaments built into them, so that people want to set up brackets and play them at whatever level. That should be so easy to do. I don't know why people don't do it, because, you know, the reason that I've become so competitive with X-Wing is because there are constantly tournaments happening near me in Bristol, because it's relatively easy to do and the stores that support it, and it's popular enough to do it all the time. And you think a video game, surely that would work. The other side of it is, there's something about competing with somebody, even a stranger who you meet across the table at an event, and you shake hands before you play and you talk to them as you're playing, because it's a 75-minute round. You know, you take the time to meet somebody. And that actually weirdly does happen on Tabletop Simulator, because the people who are there is a self-selecting group of people who are probably already comfortable with that. And also, most of the games are complicated enough that the game designers can't rely on text chat or emotes to communicate game concepts. You need to be able to express to your opponent, I'm going to do this now, and I'm going to do it in this way. And so voice chat is sort of included by default. People are used to using it. But for the majority of competitive games, video games, that sense of, I actually kind of got a sense, like, I didn't just play against a bunch of people. I actually met, like, you know, I met like 18 people over the weekend. I met loads of people, but I met 18 people specifically who I sat down with for an hour, and we played a game and one of us won. And I came away with a sense of them, you know? Like, and that's a really, like, who gets frustrated, who doesn't? There was a guy who built his entire list and themed it all around a single episode of Rebels, which is the cartoon. And he was my first opponent in the National, and I was like, thank God, because it was a bad list. But but it was really nice, because it was like, you know, we were sat there, like, coming up with reasons why this might happen in the fiction, like my Imperial list versus his. Like, we're having a season finale, right? Like, and then the next one's hyper competitive, and it's all about the meta, and that sort of thing. Maybe it's a bit like, I've been in the Dota bath for so long, one of the most toxic, hostile, shitty places you can be in a competitive game. That coming out into the real world and people are actually all right, but it's as competitive, is like, I don't know, like this immersion thing where I'm now feeling it, but I don't know. I don't know how games get that.
Yeah.
Video games are like so impersonal on that one. I don't know. I'm part of the problem because I just don't use voice comms. I hate it. I'll turn it off I'll leave it on until someone speaks, and then I'll go into the options and turn it off because I realize, oh, I just don't want to hear that. I think it's like, I mean, the quality is always terrible because it's, I don't think that's even a bandwidth thing. I think it's just like everyone has different mics and it's always going to be a crapshoot. And then there's just something like, I don't know, the social brain is weird. Like, if you meet someone in a public place, you just kind of accept them on some level and you're sort of like, I don't know, all the social graces kick in and you kind of want to know about them. And even if they, like, everything they ever say is so completely at odds with the kind of person you are, and you just think, oh, we're not going to get on at all, you still kind of like go along with it and have a conversation. Whereas when the first time someone speaks in a multiplayer game, it's just this weird intrusion. It's like, I'm playing this like for me, it's, you know, in my room, physically on my own, playing against other people. The social part of the working together as a team and defeating other people and being defeated by other people all feels like a natural part of that. And then when people talk, it feels totally unnatural and weird, unless it's my friends, in which case it's it's like having a phone call while you're playing the game. But the other, like, voice comms with strangers is like someone randomly calling you in the middle of the game and saying, "Hey, I'm playing this game. You're like, I need you to heal me." And I don't know exactly why I find it so intrusive, but I don't get along with it at all. I still, even knowing that it would probably help me, I still don't want to use it.
There's got to be some interesting psychology reason for this. Like, you meet somebody, you're probably if you meet somebody across the table, whether you go to a Magic the Gathering event or X-Wing or anything else you'd be playing, Warhammer, there's like a social warm-up. In this case, it's like I go over and I find my table number and I go to my table and maybe I'm there first and I wait and then someone shows up, and because it's the only thing that makes sense to do, you like introduce yourself, you know, like, because the way they did it, you just get your table number, you don't get the name of your opponent. So you just like, "Oh, I'm Chris," and then you find out who they are, and then you're like half getting to know them and you're half desperately eyeing what they've brought with them because you want to see how the matchup works and whether it'll work in your favor and that kind of thing. But the whole process is like, it's kind of about the fact that you're meeting them, and you kind of have to negotiate the kind of like, "Here's my list, here's yours," and then you do it. Whereas in a video game, everything is anonymous until the point where someone speaks. Like, it sort of almost skips to the middle stage of, there's no small talk. There's no kind of, "Oh, so how far have you come to get here?" There's no, like,
it bypasses all the non-verbal communication that happens when you actually, like, when you meet someone, you could just make eye contact, shake their hands, whatever, say hello. At that moment, you're in a social contract to behave in a certain way and kind of not be a dick in a way that never ever, that moment of establishment and connection never ever happens online, and kind of can't. And I don't know how it could ever happen. Even if you had everyone, all their faces on the screen at the same time, it's not going to replicate that moment.
It'd be horrible.
It would actually be worse.
I think we had a question on a previous podcast about playing Overwatch alone with other people, and I said that, like, something I always do is use the hello emote at the start of games just to see who will hello back, because that feels, that does feel like a bit like a handshake. It's kind of like, it is like there's another human being here and they are also kind of willing to participate.
Yeah. You can't force that as well. You can't use, it's very difficult to build a system that forces that. I mean,
yeah, you could have something where, so there's like setup times in Overwatch games, and in theory you could do like some kind of awful thing where you like pick pairs of players and say, "Okay, you got to introduce yourself now, and you've got like 30 seconds to say who you are to this person," or maybe to the whole team, and then each person gets their own thing, and it's like a sort of like somewhere between like speed dating and a kind of awkward, like,
those awful corporate
club
events
that you
where
go
they
to.
Make everyone stand up with the sticker on there.
Yeah, exactly.
Go, "My name is Tom and I'm a games journalist."
And you could do that, and it might eventually lead to better like team play and people feeling more comfortable with each other once the game starts, but I would just never play the game if that was in there.
That situation, right?
If it was optional, no one would do it, and if it was compulsory, no one would play it.
This said, actually, something occurs to me is that this way of being in multiplayer is only the case because we lost the idea of like consistent servers that people would visit day in, day out.
Yeah.
And also MMOs without instancing and all that stuff. Like, the introduction of, like, I guess, matchmaking queue-based multiplayer plus, you know, heavily instanced MMOs kind of takes away what would maybe like a passive social element. Because I remember playing Team Fortress Classic as a kid, or as a teenager, on the same GameSpy servers and the same Wireplay servers, seeing the same names, and maybe you don't speak to them the first time you go, but eventually something will break the ice and then you'll get to know people and then you join clans and stuff. And like, that is very similar to a real thing. That's very similar to going to the same pub, you know, every week until that person you see there every time, eventually something triggers a conversation between you, and then you know each other.
Yeah.
And then, like, I remember even having this in TF2 where there were certain servers that I enjoyed going to because there were regulars on there, and the way they spoke with other people evoked a certain atmosphere that I found enjoyable to be a part of and wasn't aggressive and was more kind of welcoming and fun. So it's even just like a passive thing where you absorb the passive sense of a community, and that is appealing as well.
I think that's closer to it, actually, because like, I found that with X-Wing that, you know, I've been to a couple of different clubs and I have now my set, right? And I'm kind of like, I'm friends with people that whose competitive progress I care about, and we track, you know, we keep track of each other's games, and that one of the big rewards of this weekend was we were all there, a lot of us did well, and there were those moments after games where you'd look try and catch, see where someone was in the room during their game and see if they're still playing. And if they're not still playing, give them the look. And there's only one response to the look, which is a thumbs up or a thumbs down based on whether you won or lost. Because there's only one question that gets asked, and it's like, how did it go? And that's really nice. But it came from like going to clubs and not necessarily knowing anyone and being a bit awkward. But then the game itself is an icebreaker, which is something I guess games struggle to do.
Sure.
But like, and then you get to know people and those, and you see other people socializing and you become part of other people's conversations and it all adds up. And I think games actually did have that. I think MMOs had that. I think, ironically, Star Wars Galaxies has that. Had that. And encouraged it very well. But convenience, and I guess the notion of games as a service that you plug into for a few hours just to play and unplug from, I think that's maybe the fundamental thing that's been lost. Like, they tried to reintroduce it with Dota, actually, with regional chat channels. So when you load Dota, you are forced to join, like, it alternates between putting me in London and Bristol here in Bath. It should be Bristol, but it alternates between the two. And I guess maybe they wanted to create the sense that you log in addition to just playing the game or your own friends list, you also see a chat channel which is like Dota players near you, which would be quite a nice idea if they weren't all shits. So I don't know, maybe that community is just too far gone that even when you can see that, like, there was something sort of not like mind-blowing, but at least thought-provoking about being in the Bristol chat and seeing just as much, like, it's seeing nothing be different. Everything is just as crazily racist. The English is just as broken. All you know, it's exactly the same. So you know, the lazy Dota assumption that, you know, oh, you know, the people, things people talk about, like, oh god, I got matched with Russians again, and they moan about that constantly,
right?
Completely unfounded, clearly, because I challenge you to tell the difference between a regular matchmaking game of Dota and Bristol chat or London chat.
Yeah,
like, it's awful, really terrible. And like, I mean, maybe that's at that point just because the game itself makes people bad.
Yeah, but it's interesting that it kind of feels like establishing these communities needs to be down to the communities themselves, but it always feels like the game should provide the tools to let those communities forge that. And most multiplayer games don't have that. That kind of architecture has been disappearing over the last 5-10 years. Maybe that's what we should all be sad about.
Weirdly, like the games that have most quickly formed some kind of like fondness for another person are games where they don't let either of you talk to each other. Journey. I've talked before about a game called Way that I played at the IGF one year that was on PC, where like it's a split screen platformer and you are both playing along. Oh, sorry, it's not split screen, but you can see the other person's, you're both in separate worlds and you see the other person walking along platforms just as you are. But if you're the blue player, any blue platform you see on their screen, they can't see. And so you have to communicate to them whether or not it's clear to go or whether they should jump or that kind of stuff. But you can only just point your arms in different directions, like your character's arms, by pressing like, I think, directional, sticks and stuff. And after I played that, like most games I played at the IGF, I was kind of, after I played it, I wanted to meet the creator. And after I played that one, I wanted to meet the person I've been playing with because we hadn't been able to talk the whole time, but we'd had this great, we'd forged relationship. We'd learned to trust each other.
Right, yeah.
I'd saved his life. He'd saved my life. I'd felt terrible guilt when I got him killed. And you go through all that. And then like, I'm willing to talk to that person, like no matter how bad quality their mic is.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like using the game as an icebreaker, but like holding off the talking until the end.
Yeah.
Because then, yeah, I don't know. So it's been like, I mean, it's been a great experience, but it's like, I don't know if me drifting away slightly from, not that I won't play Dota or I'm not interested in that sort of stuff. I'm still me. It's just, it's just that.
Is it an existential dread? Is it the endless kind of toil to get nowhere?
Yeah, exactly. It's I mean, it's not like I ever really anticipated that, oh, if I play this enough, I'll win the international.
Right.
That's not really how it works, you know? It's like the last boss.
It seems like there's nothing for you to strive for apart from the very
top. I think they and most competitive games have done quite a bad job at adding mid-level goals, honestly. I think every competitive game fucks that up. I think one of the better systems actually is Hearthstone's, and it only works because it's a solo game, which is that you earn points, you climb a ladder, and eventually if you get high enough up the ladder, you can you can get your ranking within the within your region or whatever. It's Tom prepping another delicious G&T there as loudly as humanly possible.
No quiet way to do this.
They're very good G&Ts. But yeah, like I don't know. So I suppose, I mean, I don't want to, I'm a bit conscious of rambling about a miniatures game on a PC gaming podcast, but it is, I think there's a decent crossover with interests, because it has been personally gratifying to shift my interest in that way, in a way that I suspect might also be replicable for other people who may be in my situation, like really into competitive stuff, but frustrated with the grind. Like, your option is not just to commit 1,000 hours of your life to getting a better Dota MMR, or whatever, whether it's League rank or your Counter-Strike rank or whatever it is you care about. Like, I mean, obviously, the caveat to this is, you know, that success is tremendous success in a huge pool of people, and to get to the top percent means a huge amount when there are millions of people playing these games, whereas me being, I don't know, 79th out of 400 people who come to a big national X-Wing tournament is comparatively not as impressive. But at the same time, at least I know where I stand relative to other people who play the game, and at least I can meet the people who are among the best people who play the game and play against them, and that kind of thing. And
you get that rich kind of interpersonal element that you
exactly
have been lacking, perhaps, with
absolutely pub play, especially as a solo thing. It's also and it also just encourages you to for one thing, the bad habit that most competitive video gamers get into is blaming other people for their cheesy opponents, and some of that is true of miniatures stuff, but it's way harder to do.
Yeah,
like it's way harder to be their dick in that way when it's not anonymous. So it kind of goes both ways. It's not just about other people are better behaved; it's that it kind of encourages better behavior in you. And I think, as someone who has a very long-standing interest in competitive psychologies, that's been really interesting. Is like the ways you might be tempted to act online become so transparently absurd straight away that you don't do them in real life, and therefore doing them in online competitive games is also obviously stupid. Yeah.
Right, yeah. I think it's interesting to look at this stuff and actually look at where video games fall down enormously.
Yeah.
In these the same contexts. So it's a fun thing to analyze, I think.
Shout out to, I think, Greg, who is a Crate and Crowbar listener, who completely destroyed me in my first my first Bristol Store Championship in my first round.
Grats, okay. Greg.
Yeah.
So
he said, are you from Crate and Crowbar? And then proceeded to wreck me.
Maybe you tried extra hard.
Yeah, I hope so.
What have any of us been playing? I think we've all been in similar...
Yeah, so I've been playing Hitman and Overwatch, which both of which I talked about last week.
And last month, to be fair.
Probably, yeah.
Well, Hitman.
So Hitman has really got us by the balls now, because...
keeps on doing new
things. They're releasing an episode every month, which is a huge chunk of new stuff. It would be kind of absurd not to talk about that. And then they're doing the Elusive Targets, like, seemingly at least once a month. There's another Sapienza one happening next week.
Huh.
So we'll probably be talking about it next week as well. But when I talked about it last week, why do I keep saying month? I just tried Marrakesh for the first time. I just had one clumsy run of it, and that was it. And I've now played it loads. And I've got, like, most of the assassination challenges. The challenges system is, like, it's weird, but it does work. I want to get, not all of them, but I want to get all the kind of main ones, and there'll be a couple of Easter egg ones where it's just like, I don't really know how to do that, or like, that's difficult. But I've been trying to get, like, so there's two targets in Marrakesh. There's one, an army general who's in a disused school, and a ambassador who's in a consulate, sorry, a banker who's in a consulate. And the, as you, like, one of the rewards you get for doing these challenges and leveling up is you get to pick different spawn locations and start undercover or sort of already in a disguise somewhere. And that's really good. That's the best part of the kind of level up system. The other part of the level up system is it locks off certain bits of equipment, which with Paris was a real problem because you start with nothing virtually. And so you can't, there's no poison, there's no sniper rifle, there's no remote explosives, and you have to you have to get loads of achievements before you ever get access to those things. And that bothered me. And so, like, after Sapienza, I had unlocked all the things I cared about in that respect. And so then the question is, like, how do they keep unlocking stuff? And the answer is, well, it gets kind of more esoteric. Like, I now have three different kinds of poison. One that kills them, one that knocks them out, and one that makes them go to the bathroom. I've just got a combat knife, which I didn't know was even coming. And that's the thing that's just, in practical terms, that's not any more useful than anything you already have. Like, if you want to do a lethal kill, fiber wire is better. And there's, you just unlock a bunch of stuff that's just like, you might want to use that for style reasons. But the starting location is a really good thing because that's per location, obviously. So every new episode, they're always going to have a whole bunch of those to get through, and it's always going to be exciting to unlock them because it's both sometimes gives you access to an area that was very difficult to get to otherwise. And even if it doesn't, it's like a kind of shortcut. It's kind of like, it's both, let's simplify this for you. So if you're, if you've done this a bunch of times and you already know how to get the waiter's disguise and be in the shisha cafe and do this, then let's not make you do that each time. If you want to start there, you can start there. And also it kind of encourages you to sort of try different things. Like there's one that just starts on the rooftops. You're like, oh, why would I want to be on the rooftops? Let's try that. So I started as the general in, I started as a like elite troop in the school to take on the general. And there's, I found loads of different ways to get him. I managed to kick a toilet onto him, which is a good one.
The Half-Life 2 memorial kill.
Yeah. The banker, I've killed him with a moose.
As in?
A giant stuffed moose.
Oh, okay. Suspended not like from a like hair moose or...
No. I've electrocuted him, and I there's a picture in the challenge to electrocute him that shows a lighting, sort of a lighting rig. And there are some lighting rigs around where he is, but I was like, how do you use that? Because, like, he's never going to... Usually electrocution means they've got to stand in, like, a pool of water, right? You sort of... There's this elaborate process, like, on Sapienza where you've got to turn the power to this fan off, then strip the wire with the screwdrivers, then turn the hose on so water leaks onto it, then go back and turn the power back on so the electricity is now exposed to the water and then someone steps in and they die. But this fan had none of that. It was just by itself. I'm like, how do I do that? I found the switch to turn it on and off, and I can get to it, and I expose the wire. But when is the banker ever going to walk up to the like lighting rig and just touch the wire? And I couldn't figure it out. And so I watched him go near it, and he leans on the balcony looking over this open area, and it's like a really obvious opportunity to push him off. And I'm like, okay, I'm not going to do that. I want to do the electrocution thing. And I waited and waited. He never goes near the light, just walks off again. And so I reloaded and thought, oh, this is weird. And then I just kind of... I thought maybe if you turn it on before he like when he's near there, he'll see the sparks and investigate or something. It would still be a bit weird, but I tried that. And I happened to try that just before he put his hands on the railing. And as soon as he put on the hands on the railing, he suddenly gibbers and falls over. And you realize, oh, that wire is touching the railing. So you electrify the whole railing, which is kind of cool. And then the general, I'd done it, like I said, I kicked a toilet onto him. I did a whole bunch of other ways. But then there was like two or three ways that all depend on this one room. And I couldn't get into it because I've got an elite soldier disguise, but there's a rank above that, which is like, I don't know, colonels or something like that. And they're all wearing like red berets, and there's only three of them in the building, and the other, there's one outside this room, and all of them can see through your disguise. There are also like two or three soldiers who can see through your disguise, and one of those is also outside this room. So there's two different people who can see through your disguise. They're right next to the door. There is no other way into this room. There is a window on the room, but you can't get into it. You can only kind of stand on the windowsill if you already get in there. And I'd experimented by just like mowing everyone down and running in there and just trying it out. But I was still trying to find a good way into it. And I finally started to kind of like snap out of the mindset you get into with Hitman, because it's so... In a weird way, it's super judgmental about, like, it only ever ranks you as to how close you got to Silent Assassin. It has challenges for all kinds of diverse and interesting playstyles, but then it tells you got a bad rating for doing them, and says you got minus 2,000 points because you did this thing that we actually incentivized you to do. And there's that, which is encouraging me not to kill anyone, not to ever be seen, not to let any bodies be found. And then there's my actual sort of natural stealth instincts, which is I don't ever want to set off alarms. I don't ever want to be shot at. I don't ever want to like be in open combat, and don't really want to be actually seen doing something, you know, absolutely, definitively criminal. And so I decided, like, let's just stick to my personal code and forget about the ratings. And so that means stop caring about killing people. And if you stop caring about killing people, you can use your silenced pistol. And in that case, there's one of those corporal guys who's in a room with only one other soldier, and both of them can see through your disguise in an instant. But as they're walking around the room, there's a kind of window opportunity where they're both looking away,
and you can walk in there just before another guy you can see through those guys walks past and headshot them both. And then getting rid of those bodies is really awkward without someone seeing through a window or through a doorway. But you can do it. And I finally got a corporal disguise. And then it's still difficult because there's like corporal who can see through the corporal disguise. But then the other guy, the lower ranking soldier, none of them can ever see through a corporal disguise. There's just like a hard and fast rule. If they're lower rank than you, they don't dare like question who you are. Not only that, but if you're dressed as a corporal, when you walk up to a lower ranking officer, you can dismiss them. You can just say, "You're dismissed, soldier. General Zayden's orders." And then they just say, "Oh, thank you, sir." And then they just go home. And like, there doesn't seem to be a limit. I think there are some you can't do it to, but anyone who's just like in the corridors, it seems like you can just go around every single one of them, just say, "Go home, go home, go home." And so you can do that to the one soldier who's outside that room, if you can get to him without the corporal seeing. And so I dismissed him, and then there's just one corporal left. And I still really don't get in this room, and they're still standing right by the doorway. There's no way to just walk past him. There's no disguise I can use that will get me past him. This is the highest ranking thing there is. There's only two kinds of people allowed here, and I'm the highest ranking one of the two. And so I finally did something that I've tried loads of times, and I never got it to work before. And I think I've just now, after three episodes and sort of probably 20 hours or so, I've just started to get the hang of like how Hitman's mechanics work, how you distract someone, what you can and can't do when someone is, you know, suspicious of you. And so I went into cover around the corner. So you just sort of cover seemed to have some kind of special status where they like really super can't see you. And then threw a crowbar past him and he saw it and he went over and he had some voice lines about how strange that was. And then he went over to investigate it. And I've done things like that, like 10 different times. And it always fucks up for me. It's always like, the last elusive target, the reason I didn't get Silent Assassin was because I was technically spotted because I hid around a corner and I threw an explosive out, not to blow anyone up, but to distract a guard so he'd go and pick it up. And as soon as he saw the explosive, he's like, "A bald guy!" And just knew exactly who I was. And I didn't really know why. And I don't think I was in cover then, so maybe you have to be in cover. But anyway, I was able to do, like, the one guy you can't get rid of for sure, or the one guy you can't get past for sure, you can distract him momentarily. The other thing I tried was killing him, obviously, because I got a science pistol, but it is... You've got to drag him one of two ways. You can't take him into the room because the room has no hiding spots for bodies. There's a window in there and you can throw him out the window, but then there's people in the yard so they see it. You can't leave him in the room because General Zayden's going to come in there. And the whole reason I wanted to get in there is to set up a certain, there's a gas thing you can set up and there's a poison thing you can set up. And if you drag him either way down different corridors, there's two different rooms where the doors open in such a way that a guard who's sitting down and who never gets up can always see the body and he always sets off the alarm. So that's why I knew I can kill him. And then finally distract him from the crowbar and then just like slip past him. And then even then it's a little bit tricky because the window that I'd done it in, General Zayden was on his way to the office. And the guy, my save, is when the guard has just gone to investigate the crowbar and he's standing there looking at it puzzled, which he does for like 30 seconds. It's a difficult puzzle. And then I've got to do whatever, like, you know, sabotaging this gas tank and then I've got to turn off a lamp, then sabotage a gas tank, and then open a safe and get a code because there's a thing I want to do, and then also call the other target from his phone whilst in that room. And he's like 10 feet away walking towards me all this time. And I've got to do all of that before the guy stops being confused by a crowbar and turns around. Because as soon as he turns around, he will see me. He will eventually go back to his post and face away from me. But by that point, General Zayden will be in the room, so that's no good. And so figuring out all the mathematics of just that little microcosm, just this one room, I just spent like an hour trying to, well, probably not that long, but a long time figuring out how to get in there. And I finally did it and finally got all the things I wanted. And yeah, it's brilliant. I think Marrakesh is really, really good. And now that I understand all the mechanics, I'm getting a lot more into just, you know, the basic experience of playing the new Hitman.
Do you think they could have taught you how those kind of intermediate levels of suspicion work?
I think Paris was the worst place to learn because it was so high security and so brutal. And the opportunities, which I turned off, which was a mistake, are so hard to discover by accident. Like, there are a couple that kind of do come into your path, but then there's... a lot of the most useful ones are just things where, like, if you didn't go to this huge crowd of people and then go to the back right corner and then stand there for 30 seconds until someone starts speaking, you wouldn't know about this thing. And Sapienza, I think if that had been the first episode, almost all of my problems would have gone away, because it was open enough that you can just experiment and mess around, and it's fun to do that, and I'm happy to learn in that environment. But Paris was so oppressive, and so like everything you did was just like game over, basically. Mm.
Yeah, cool. I still haven't done any of the Lucid Targets. I'll definitely do the next one. I still haven't been to Marrakesh. I've only like walked around Sapienza for a minute. It feels like one of the great thing I really should be playing that I'm not at the moment, which is presumably what this kind of episodic structure really gives the Hitman series, a sense of urgency and there being new things to try.
It's interesting because I do think they chose the first episode wrong, but it's the episode structure has sort of forgiven it. Like, it would be really interesting to compare what this would have been like if they just launched with all of them at once. Because, if the first level of your game is not the best one, I mean, that seems to be the consensus of reviews as well. Does that end up, negatively affecting your reviews, or do you get forgiven because people immediately find the next level and then see that that's cool?
Also, perhaps, there's an argument. I mean, obviously, all these things are in development for a while, but it is possible for them to have tweaked things or, maybe adjusted certain things based on feedback.
Yeah.
I don't know how viable that is on it, because they're so detailed, these levels, that they must presumably be well on the way by the time any of them come out. But
one thing they definitely changed about Paris was I mocked them on Twitter for, well, not to their face, but just generally, for the fact that the icons for stairs going up and down, the icon for down was a left arrow and the icon for up was a right arrow. And they both just have a picture of stairs and then a left arrow. And looking at that in isolation, it's like, oh, is that up or down? I don't know. If you go left from the right-hand side of this pictogram, I guess you'd be going upstairs, but you'd be starting from the downstairs. And then after Sapienza, there's an up arrow and there's a down arrow. Oh, that's a good idea. Well done.
But nonetheless, right, like, it's possible that they're getting better at it. It seems, it's interesting, like, every time we write about this on PC Gamer, there is always a comment by someone who simply won't play it in its current form. They will play it when it's
not
out.
Finished, right.
And it doesn't matter, like, I read this on, I think, Phil's review of the latest episode of Marrakesh. Like, and it just strikes me as a really weird hill to die on. Like, I mean, it's not like, PC gaming, particularly, even among gaming, is pretty rich in people who have really principled stands against stuff that probably doesn't matter.
It's our specialty.
Saying this is the line in the sand and I will not cross it, about things that they probably wouldn't notice if they weren't specifically looking for them. And episodic stuff is a case of that. There's certainly been bad episodic stuff, but if something is good and episodic and doesn't cost more and you're not really losing out, then I don't really get it. Particularly, a lot of the time it's like, I love Hitman, but I won't play this unless I can play it all at once.
Mm.
And I do wonder about, when you played the original Hitman games, much did you play it all at once? And how much was your experience governed by the fact that was how you played it? It's such a strange thing. Like, I simply don't see where.
Yeah, I actually think this is a better way to play it. If I had the willpower, I probably would play a Hitman game one mission a month and really study it. Probably I wouldn't have spent a month on Paris, but
you don't have to either. You can play it and you're done with it, and then you play something else. And then, I suppose I understand that if you simply want to play through the entire thing and never have to wait, then it might be frustrating to finish and feel like you've got to wait for months.
Maybe there are people who are super into the story and they really want to know what the next cutscene is going to be like.
Let's be serious.
There's one at the end of each mission, and they're sort of like, they're reasonably well produced. They're kind of just like, the mood of them, I think, is relatively appropriate for the game. It's kind of conspiracies and people meeting in shadows and saying sinister things to each other, but I'm not following it at all.
I can't remember anything.
By the time you see the next one, you've totally forgotten what the last two were, so that plot wise episodic is not so good.
Plot, though, in Hitman games,
it's always
never
been
ever
a mistake.
Been useful,
really. Like, the best Hitman game is Blood Money, where the plot is someone is telling someone else about a bunch of missions Hitman did and then each one
here's what they are.
I say that, but I am more and more interested in the targets and what they say when you follow them around and how it connects. Like, there's always a relationship between the two. So far, in all three cases, there's been one who's seen as like the idiot and the other one's the smart one, and the other one's usually like planning to kill or in some way betray the idiot one. And in this one, I was just listening to some of the stuff the general says, and it was actually like, this is actually a plot development. Like, what would happen if I didn't kill them? I now know something about that. I now know something about how it would have unfolded. Like, it's not just that they are both conspirator masterminds who are going to pull off some perfect plan. It's like they're bickering between themselves, and they have their own agendas and stuff. And I can't decide if I care how it all fits together. Because there's also, now that I say it, there's like, once I went back and sort of properly enjoyed Paris, learning about how their organization works and all the snippets you pick up over multiple playthroughs, you start to sort of kind of piece more and more of it together and see how it fits.
Feels like that's a really good organic way for the game to deliver plot.
Yeah.
Cutscenes is just the antithesis of that, isn't it?
Yeah.
And they truly do not matter and never have in Hitman. So I don't know why they spend loads of money on making them.
I guess what I'd say is, like, they obviously care more about the plot than I do, but the way they're presenting it to me is a lot less kind of intrusive or annoying than certainly a lot of the previous Hitman games. Like, even Hitman 2, which is a great game. The first mission of that, which is good, one of the objectives is to rescue your priest friend because you have friends now. And, like, he's the only one who truly understands you, and he forgives you for all your sins and stuff. And it's like, what the fuck are you doing? Hitman doesn't have friends.
I always loved Splinter Cell Chaos Theories. There are a lot of games did this in that period, actually, where they were like basically briefing screens, and there were tabs that you could click on, and they would each initiate a certain amount of like dialogue, briefing dialogue that would give you background. And they were all completely optional, and you could listen to them as much as you wanted to get the kind of character stuff, or read them if you didn't want to listen to the whole thing. And it basically just gave you all of the choice about what elements of the plot you wanted to pick and choose, and to what extent you wanted to even just listen to people talk about it. And then you just pressed go on the mission, and you went, and I always really liked that.
Clint Locking did a playthrough of a Chaos Theory mission recently for the tenuous reason that it was set in Panama, and so the Panama Papers happened. Yeah. And it's him and another level designer from Chaos Theory and a bunch of other Splinter Cell games, who I think it's someone who now works with him on his new thing at Ubisoft. But that was really fun to watch. I remember that mission. It's a bank in Panama, and you can rappel down from the ceiling and lower yourself through a laser grid and stuff. And that game has a lot of writing in it. Like, there's a lot of kind of, as well as the background plot and stuff, there's a lot of like dialogue, banter between you and Grim Stoddier. And and who is your? I think it's Redding, isn't it? Your CO or commander or whatever. Which at the time I didn't know who Patrick Redding was, and now that I do, I realise he's named after Patrick Redding, who is, I think he was the director on like Blacklist. Was that a recent Splinter Cell game? The last one, I think, he was the lead designer on. But yeah, that playthrough is really good.
What have you been playing, Tom?
Oh, PC games. I'm still playing a lot of the same stuff I've been playing recently. So Total War, most notably, which is an interesting one, really, Total War. Because as much as I acknowledge its kind of flaws that have always been the case with Total War, I've had some really good battles in it. Like, really climactic, meaningful fights. Not many, but enough for me to have really... to have made the whole thing worthwhile, to be honest.
Who are you playing as?
So I'm playing as so I played as all of them for a couple of hours, like, just to road test what they were like. And the ones I settled on are the dwarves. And they're... I think the reason I like them so much is because of where they're situated on the world map and the way that that part of the world map is designed. And the world map is, they've got this beautiful kind of strategic layer world map. It looks absolutely gorgeous. But it's also, because it doesn't have to be the planet Earth, it can have a lot of very strange kind of mountainous regions and routes through that wouldn't necessarily be geographically, you know, believable if it wasn't set in a fantasy world. So the dwarves are, obviously their strongholds are in the mountains. And the mountains have a lot of very clear routes that are very easily defended if you want to turtle. And turtling is what dwarves do. They're very, very slow. They've got good artillery, good guns. They're very, very tough. So they want to sit still and they want to build and build and build. And the scenario for that region when you take a dwarf campaign is that you're being constantly assaulted by the orcs, who are the vast, fast barbarian hordes that are constantly assaulting you from all angles. And then whenever you push out, that's a huge thing. Like, the moment you take a new province, you're going to have to camp an army there, you're going to have to reinforce that zone. You're going to have to build defences there so that eventually, like, it can grow up and you can leave it to its own devices, and it might be able to repel some orc armies and stuff. But every so often, the orcs form a wah, which is the Games Workshop kind of lore reason for what for orcs clumping together into a huge ball of, you know, killy death. And they like to raid, like, sometimes two or three fully stacked armies on the campaign map. And they're an absolute, like, they're a boil you've got to lance at some point. But actually breaking them down and catching them in the right circumstance to defeat them is very difficult, particularly with dwarves who aren't very mobile. So what you get in the dwarf campaign are these moments where you've built, I had two armies, and they had, like, huge cannons, and they had some good, well-leveled up elite units that were they were veterans. And they were fighting three fully stacked orc armies. And there was one battle where all of them went onto the field at the same time. And it was the make or break battle for that campaign. Because if my armies were broken, it would take me 10 turns to get any sort of army back together. I would have lost most of my territory. And at that point, the amount of time it would have taken to bounce back is better to just restart the campaign. So that's campaign over. That's the dwarves dead. And it was a huge blessing when I got onto the map. And you get into your deployment phase, and there was a bloody great big hill right in my deployment zone. And as the dwarves, that's the best thing you could ever see. Like, you just want to, you want the orcs to constantly charge at you, come up that those hills, and there are mechanics that make, you know, exhaustion is a mechanic in the game that decreases people's effectiveness as they're fighting uphill, and also you get extra kind of shooting rounds against them because they're slower going uphill, etc., etc. And so I spent like 10 minutes just planning everything, like what would happen, because it's not straightforward as simply putting. So I had like 1500 to 2000 troops, but 1000 of them were going to come onto the field after the battle had started because they were reinforcing. So I had to build a very fragile position on the hill, and there were mostly just catapults, loads of catapults, and then a few just kind of narrow melee units to defend them, which I put in a kind of U shape around them, like a horseshoe around them protectively. And the way this was going to work was the artillery were going to have to hammer the 3,000 orcs that were coming at me. And the dwarves that were coming on from behind me, the reinforcing dwarves, were going to have to run so fucking fast that they would get in front of my artillery and defend it while the artillery actually did all the work. So there was this absurd race where the orcs had to travel like 2/3 of the map distance and the dwarves had to travel 1/3. But the dwarves are so fucking slow that it was a genuinely tense race for them to actually get in front of my artillery up the hill and to crash down into the orcs and defend it. And at that point it was like, you must hold, hold, hold. General is constantly just shouting at his men to just hold, just don't break. And the rock lobbers and the cannons constantly smashing into their veteran orc units. And after about, it took an hour. It was like an hour, almost an hour long battle, because I was constantly pausing and constantly like redirecting troops and reshaping the line. And it's one of the rare battles where the Total War system works really correctly, where that granular control over individual units actually translates into like meaningful decision making. And there's the moment where I killed, there were three orc generals on the field, there were three like enemy armies coming at me, I killed two of them, and then two of those armies routed, and the kind of infectious effect of routing also routed the third army. And it happened, I'd done it, of like 3,000 orc troops just watching them run. And as dwarves, there's no point even pursuing. There's nothing you've got that can run them down. A huge point of part of Total War at the end of a battle is, oh, you send your fast units to chase down the important units. Dwarves, nah, you just present battle, because there's nothing. You just sit on the hill, just have a rest. Drink.
Oh, there they go, lads.
Yeah, there they go, lads. They'll come back in a few turns, but, you know, whatever, we've done it. And that was that huge kind of moment translated into success on the campaign map afterwards, because you can chase them down on the campaign map, even if they flee. Because you get a little bit of movement afterwards if you haven't made a full move to attack. And I just ran them down, auto-resolved, just killed the rest of the generals, completely obliterated them. And then there were like 20 turns of blissful peace. Like in role-playing terms, that's exactly how that entire scenario should be. And it was Total War always almost accidentally creates these moments, because a lot of it feels so shonky and kind of random, and sometimes you'll just get loads of armies that you can't possibly deal with, but sometimes you'll get just the right number of just the right amount of threat that will translate into a great battle that will create just this memorable war moment. I have so many of these moments from various Total War games, like Empire as well, and in that moment the fantasy was such a good fit for it that I was greatly satisfied by it. It was really fun.
It's funny because like I remember a couple of podcasts ago, I think I was talking about my experience with the campaign so far, and I was still playing the same campaign, which is ironic because on the podcast I was talking about how I felt like I'd fucked it.
Oh, right.
Because it was the one where like I had, as the Empire kind of expanded maybe a bit too much into different directions and lost like the back half of the Empire to endless Vikings, like chaos Vikings called Scalings that come in from the north, and also orcs while also trying to fight the vampires, and then chaos invaded and I felt like there's nothing I could do. And the chaos invasion is this sort of event, basically, that changes the face of the game for me, and it gives all of the mortal races an enormous diplomatic bonus with each other.
Mm.
So everyone gains this trait called Shield of Civilization, which is like the world is ending. It's not, there's no time to be pissed off at the dwarves, you know. Mm. And so I became military allies with everybody, which allowed you to coordinate targets and stuff, and it becomes this sort of faction wide thing. But like I'm leading this basically like ragged half empire where half the parts of the empire are still independent. Most of my own territory's gone. I've got a couple of armies, but you lose people and the battle's really hard. And like the first time I defeated Archaon Ever Chosen, who's the chaos leader in the field, it felt like a big moment, but he comes back again.
Hmm.
And so there was that amazing moment, but then it started to fade because it had that Total War thing of like nothing ever feels complete or fixed.
Yeah.
Like, which I think is actually quite a deliberate thing within that series that you don't really get that satisfaction of like my base is done now, because everything is always suboptimal or broken or about to be broken. You're just spinning plates and something is always smashing. And then he comes back, and I assumed that the end times, like chaos, was a permanent threat that was going to grind me down. So I started to consider stopping the campaign not long after where I was when I spoke about it, because it's like I can kind of see the writing on the wall. Like, this keeps coming. And I have time to fight it off, but I don't have time to beat it. And based on just, you know, basically, you know, based on past experience with these games, I'd assumed that I'd failed the early game to an extent that while I could survive this late game, I wasn't going to win. And that was where a lot of my dissatisfaction with the game had come from, I guess, was the feeling that it wasn't capable of generating the genuinely interesting fantasy story out of a compromised situation, that it was the type of strategy game, and there are lots of them like this, where if you don't succeed absolutely, you should probably restart.
Yeah.
Which is true of something like Civ, to be honest, as well, a lot of the time. And then actually what happened is, and it was the total anticlimax, because by this point I'd actually gotten a bit bored with the battles, and I think the Empire is a bit boring. Like, I think I found that. Like, there are interesting things about the politics, but I was finding the campaign map game much more interesting than the battles a lot of the time, because also, like I think I said last time, Total War tends to swing between, you know, either so one-sided that there's no point, you might as well, it's your huge stack versus 20 Vikings, just auto-resolve it. Don't waste your life, like, charging your dudes at them, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Equally, you get the other way around, where it's like, you can't defend that town, it's being hit by the full force of the enemy, you're not going to gain anything from steering three units of garrison spearmen into position, so just let it go.
Yeah.
And then occasionally you get the army-on-army battles, which I don't tend to resolve, until, actually, I started to get a bit auto-resolve shy, because I think, and I don't know if this is true for every faction, but I have definitely encountered, and this is a huge failing of the game, in my opinion, I've definitely encountered multiple battles that are extremely difficult to win on the field. Like, extremely difficult to win due to quirks of the AI and movement and so on.
Yeah.
But you will always win, and win well, if you auto-resolve them. Because the maths of the auto-resolve algorithm, which is based on, I guess, army composition and size and stuff, doesn't account for the weird janky shit that can happen in the engine. So, like, you know, I've had, like, you know, if you have, like, I like my Imperial artillery, like the big cannons and the guns and the volley and the field Gatling guns and stuff.
Yeah.
And fighting Chaos Forever, they have Chaos Hounds. And if a Chaos Hounds get onto a expensive Gatling gun, they will eat all 9 crew immediately, and there's something you can fucking do, and that expensive unit is gone. And if you want it back, that's another 5 turns of planning and logistics and moving things around the map. If you auto-resolve those battles, you will wipe the floor with them and they will never touch your artillery. If you don't auto-resolve them, the battle AI will do weird flanky shit where it will run in, run away again, run in, run away again, and you have to park at least one unit of infantry right on top of the guns just to ensure they don't just get snatched out from underneath you when you're not looking or you're concentrating on something else.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's fiddly and feels a bit crap. Like, it doesn't feel right. And, like, I've had frustrating situations where my own units have blocked my other units just by the way they're moving around the battlefield or the way they've routed. And your men can't fluidly run through each other to bail out the unit you're trying to protect. And frustrations like that get to the point where I just started going auto-resolve. Like, if it's a matchup that's mostly in my favor and I can see, like, problem units, I'll auto-resolve. Because worst-case scenario, you do, like, two crew on one gun that you regenerate in two turns, whereas outright losing them most of the time. So that created loads of really negative loops. And I got to the point where I was auto-resolving. And then another Chaos Horde arrived, and I auto-resolved, beat it, chased it down, auto-resolved, killed the general. And then the end times ended. And I got the message that said, peace has arrived, and the Chaos is gone. And like, and I got the message that said, Chaos Warriors have been destroyed. Like, that faction doesn't exist. And I'm still at war with the Vikings and stuff. But the thing that I was expecting wouldn't happen happened, which is that, like, I had this amazing, like, what happens now moment where that thread had ended. And I assumed that my campaign would end around turn 110, and now I'm on turn 190. And suddenly, so initially it's great because I'm at peace and military allies with almost everybody that isn't evil, explicitly evil. I'd actually made peace with the vampires for now just to kind of concentrate on getting rid of Chaos. And I had this amazing, it was a similar sort of feeling, I guess, to after you defeat the war, where you can go and just like repair all your territories, recolonize towns that have been razed to the ground, build walls everywhere, like repair my economy, get a few armies up and fix everything. But as this is happening, every mortal faction has now lost the Shield of Civilization trait. So slowly but surely, the bonds between all of these different allies are fraying, and that feels like a proper scenario of a fantasy novel. Like, eventually people are going to fall out. And it's already started to happen. Like, and I'm actually within reach of my, like, every faction has different short and long campaign victory criteria. And I am so close to mine. Like, but it's become really interesting because, and again, this is, like, campaign map interesting. Like, I think I've kind of given up on the battle level game being interesting for me now, I think. Because I haven't, I'd like to play a different faction. I'll try Dwarves after this. But I need to retain control of a particular territory because it's part of the Empire. One of my criteria is I have to have united the Empire under my rule. And I have done, with the exception of a big chunk of it, which now belongs to Bretonnia, which is basically France, like medieval France, because it got raised by Chaos and then resettled by them. So it's completely their territory now. And they have been like my most steadfast ally forever. And as long as I'm military allies with them, that counts towards my victory condition because I need to either own it or it needs to be controlled by a military ally, which is fine. Because for a while I was like, am I going to have to go for war with them like eventually? But the problem is everyone's standing with everyone else is deteriorating. And because I'm so powerful now, they are automatically deteriorating towards me. So every couple of turns, I need to account for just giving them a shitload of money just to make them happy. So I've got this sort of thing and I'm playing that long game, but I also need to like move into position to just destroy the vampire counts once and for all, because that's my final victory thing, is to just wipe them out, unite the Empire, and I'm done. And I can kind of tap out, hit the win button, and be done with it. But everything else is going to shit. Like, I'm allies with all of the dwarves. One of the dwarven kingdoms is a vassal state of the Empire now. And then on the other side of those mountains are the southern kingdoms, which is like the kind of like other empire, basically, like sort of independent free states. And they've fallen out with the dwarves. And then I had the message where it's like, they've gone to war with each other. And so I chose to stay out of it, which meant breaking my military alliance with both of them. Because it was better than like getting into a war I didn't need to get into. Sure. But it's like,
vampires first.
Yeah, vampires
repair
first.
Repair that situation.
Yeah, second, but no, right. fuck it. They can do what they want.
Yeah.
Because and they are trying to contain the orcs. Now the orcs are fighting the vampires.
Right.
So I'm trying to hit the vampires from the other side. And it's become this huge fucking mess. But it's happened after like 60 turns of me getting to do the actually quite satisfying thing of just clicking the build walls button and waiting three turns and having huge walls around every city and huge garrisons so that if anything happens. And also like immediately after Chaos was defeated and we had military allies with everybody, I changed everyone's military coordination targets, which you can basically set a target for your allies, to like the deep northern Arctic capitals where the Vikings come from. And so everybody, the Bretonians, the dwarves, the free cities, everybody, were just sending armies through my territory over the sea to the icy hell land where they all die. And so they've been so the diplomacy system in Total War is not sophisticated enough from a military eyes to notice that I'd helped not at all as we destroyed like all of the outer cities belonging to them. So like push them back because they were still a problem. Like push them back far enough that you had some breathing room. But it felt kind of like rad being like Karl Franz, the emperor, sitting back, just sending them to die, knowing that it's kind of useful for me. Because I know that diplomacy is deteriorating with all these different states. I know that it's in my advantage for them to weaken themselves, basically fighting a battle that directly benefits me, because I'm the only person with a border to these people anyway.
Yeah.
So like when the Vikings attack, they attack me first anyway. So it's like, yeah, go over there and deal with them for me. And that's all felt really cool. But it's based on quite archaic stuff. Numbers, systems, and so on.
Yeah, it's a big problem with the series.
It's weird, because it is hard to say. Like, it feels very uncharitable to CA to say that it creates these moments of amazing, kind of like appropriate fantasy drama by accident. But it gets so many things weirdly wrong that it's hard to say. It's like...
For every moment you have that climactic battle, there's a moment where there's an enemy army in your territory just running from city to city, raising it repeatedly, and you can't catch up with them with your own army. Or a moment where you'll be repeatedly harried by an agent that is stopping your army over and over and over again. And agents are just so expensive that it's stupid. You'd be kind of stupid to ever buy one and, you know, counter that. So there's still like loads and loads and loads of stuff that is irritating about it. And you come away with it with the memories of the big dramatic stuff. But the even just managing provinces, and you have to constantly knock down buildings to play it correctly. Because if you're... almost everything needs a garrison. You don't want to double up on military buildings, obviously, but there are certain kind of public order buildings you need to build to counter chaos. When that threat goes away, you need to break those down and build other things that buff your economy. And there's always this constant. It's so fiddly. All of that is really boring. There's no interesting decisions there. It's just optimization.
And it takes away like a lot of the game's best moments. Like I finally built like the Altdorf College of Wizards. Which allows me to build the Luminarch of Hish. I want to keep talking in bollocks names.
That's the laser cannon.
It's basically a laser. It's like a magical wizard laser chariot.
Yeah,
and as soon as I was like, I can build this, I'm fucking building this. I felt the same way about that as a steam tank. But you also need a engineer's yard in that province.
Right.
And that, and the only city big enough is Altdorf. Mm. And like Altdorf is like a province over from Nuln, which is all about artillery and engineers and stuff. So of course I built that stuff in Nuln. And they're one turn's movement from each other. So guns get built in Nuln and they get shipped to Altdorf, and wizards get built in Altdorf. But that's what Altdorf is for. And so I've had to like knock down something in Altdorf to build the thing there. And it's like, it needs to be slightly intelligent enough to go, can't I just like announce a collaborative project, but take a penalty because I have to build it in both cities?
Mm.
You know, something like that. It takes a turn longer because I have to get a part from Nuln. Like something like that. You mentioned the reinforcement thing actually enhancing your battle earlier. Mm. But one of the reasons I most commonly auto-resolve battles, which you shouldn't do in a game where the investment has been made so much in this, you know, 3D real-time battle thing, is because the reinforcement system is so fucking stupid. Like, so if you have two armies to go above the unit cap, when you fight another army, you'll control one of them and the other one will arrive. But as far as I can tell, it will arrive from a completely random point.
Hmm.
And I've seen no correlation between their relative position on the map or what they were doing before the battle and where they come from when you play. And so a coherent strategy is actually really hard to develop, because so a good example of this is it's really bad to have your artillery in your reinforcement army, because artillery does not want to be running onto the map to, like, trying to wheel something into position. But that means putting like all your artillery in one army, and then presumably like you in position you were in, the things that need to defend the artillery in the other army. And that's maybe fine if you can set up your army next to where the reinforcements will come from. But if you can't, because they're just going to arrive from behind the enemy, which they sometimes do, or off to the side or in the woods, you're fucked. And you're just fucked by that system. There's nothing you can do about it.
Well, on the like the campaign map, where is this reinforcement army coming from?
They're adjacent enough to support each other.
Right.
So if two army stacks are next to each other, then there's like a line between them, they will support each other in battle.
You would think it would be related to their position there.
Well, the best example of this is if you have an army that's in a city and an army that's right next to the city, and they are attacked by a force that goes to siege the city.
Yeah.
That battle will take place on a random map, like not in the city. and the reinforcement army will arrive from wherever the fuck it wants. Whereas that should be a classic example of both armies are there at the start, because it's two armies that are next to each other mounting a static defense. Like, there should be scenarios where both of your armies are just on the battle at the start and you can deploy both of them.
So many mechanics are, especially with the orcs, are about developing multi-stack armies. With the WoW mechanics, where if the fightiness of an army gets above a certain amount, if you raid enough and if you fight enough, you get a free extra full stack army. They just spawn separately, and you can command them, tell them where to go, and like that's a mechanic in the game that's generating these multi stack armies. Then, when it should be more predictable when you're actually sending them into like the big crucial battles that happen always involve multi stack armies, like multiples of them. And Chris is right, it's completely unpredictable what happens. you've no idea. Like, why not just let you field them? Because the engine can handle it, because they all end up on the field eventually.
Yeah, and it creates a weird situation for the AI as well. Like, I remember when I talked about in the last podcast, my best battle at that point had been like the Empire's last-ditch heroic defense of the Moot, which is like the closest Empire territory to Vampire Land, basically.
Hmm.
And I'd arrived, Carl Francis' army had arrived like the turn before everything the vampire counts had hit the Moot all at once. So it was like three massive doomstacks versus one imperial doomstack. And I set them up on a hill in the corner of the map and then just watched as three different vampire armies arrived from completely random points, even though they'd all come together. And then because the AI wants to hit me in at once, I had to just fast forward time for probably what would have been the first 10, 15 minutes of the battle as lines of zombies and skeletons just run at each other. Gather like from all different cardinal directions, gather in the middle, then all go to one side together and then charge at me. And that should, you can skip that bit.
Right.
Skip to the bit where there's a huge zombie army running up the hill at the huge line of Imperial artillery. That's the cool bit. I don't understand the way that, like, it feels fine when you are, for example, roped in to support a military ally who's got into a fight. So the Bretonians are in a pitched battle and then my army appears at the side to charge in with the Reichsguard cavalry and save the day. That feels good because it feels right. But when it's two of your armies and you've even clicked the box that says, let me control both of them, having one of them randomly show up wherever the fuck, it doesn't work.
You get weird situations as well when you're defending smaller settlements and let's say you've got an army garrison there and the orcs attack it. You're forced into a field battle, even though I have defenses. So for example, I know I'm going to lose this battle, but I want to fight it inside the walls because
you can bleed them,
I'll bleed them, precisely. And no, it's just your men have just marched out into the field.
The garrison
no,
is
no, just don't warned. Do that. Don't leave.
That's not why I put you there.
Precisely. It's the whole
you had one job.
I knew you couldn't withstand a war. I just thought you'd bleed them a bit. But yeah, that there's so much of that stuff, like every level of the game. That it's just a hangover from decades of development, more than a decade of development on the same systems. It feels like there are so many holes in it and there's so many ways that it's just kind of creaky, and it's kind of frustrating, even though I'm kind of enjoying it.
I don't want to stop playing, and I want to play I want to play as another faction when I finish this one, because initially I thought I'd fuck this up so badly that I wanted to play the Empire again to try and get it right. But now this feels like, and this is a good thing, feels like this was my run. Like, it was a bit weird, but we kind of pulled it through, and it was compromised, and it was this sort of game of politics, and that's all cool. But I always feel like I'm playing 60% of that game. A, because there's so much going on that you can't keep track of it all. So you're never playing optimally. And B, because the number of things that are broken that you just sort of work around rather than really deal with, or simply ignore because it's too fiddly. Like, for example, the fact that every single agent you have has their own inventory and followers. Have you seriously bothered to consider whether you or not you have evenly distributed campaign movement based increasing valets among every different agent you've got?
No, exactly. No one would ever do that.
Why would you? But it's in the game.
But it's interesting to play as Chaos, actually, because Chaos, in the same way as Attila, is a great Total War game because it creates these roaming armies that remove a lot of the kind of city building nonsense that Total War has become obsessed with. And Chaos is like this because you control like a singular Chaos Horde that roams from place to place. And whenever you want, you can set your army stance to kind of encampment. And that's when you build, you grow your encampment. And then whenever you put down an encampment again, those bonuses are there again. Huh. So you pick them up and carry them with you. And for me, that solves a lot of Total War's problems because it's just one building tree just one tech tree with centralized on one army with one general. And if you want, you can subdue vassal states and have them produce separate armies. But ultimately, there's this one wonderfully focused part of your entire army that the campaign is very difficult because you start in a very difficult position. You have to basically chain wins. Otherwise, you're fucked, basically, for Chaos. But as a kind of solution to our Total War's problems, I think actually Chaos is an interesting thing. It's a shame it's a paid-for DLC that you have to buy on top of the original game. But nonetheless, I think it's an interesting experiment for them.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that there is that to say about Warhammer, Total War Warhammer, is that it has, in having these other fantasy races, it can have it so that only the Empire suffers for much of the kind of vast economy jank that the late game becomes.
That kind of, they put that in for every army. So, for example, Vampire Counts, you don't collect gold, you collect dark magic units. And the way that works is,
what's the price of a turnip in dark magic?
5 dark magic units for this turnip, sir. And it's as fiddly to generate that stuff with buildings and with trade and all that stuff.
Do you trade for... What do they get out of trade? Oh, have been trade partners with the French vampires for ages.
They probably can't trade, actually. No,
the vampires can.
Oh, can they?
I'm totally... Because there's two vampire factions, right?
Yeah.
There's vampire counts, which are like the Germanic vampires or the, you know, Sylvanian vampires. And there's Mousselon, which is the French vampires. And I'm literally trade buddies with the French vampires, which makes what I'm doing to the other vampires rather hypocritical. But
you're giving them dark magic for their turnips.
I thought I was giving them money. Shit, maybe money is the real evil.
It's Watch Dogs too.
It's the division. Exactly.
Yeah.
Everything was fine until New York Stock Exchange got taken over by vampires.
Yes.
What were we talking about?
I just remembered I did play something new this week.
Oh, wow.
I played Alan Hazelden's new game. Oh, it's going to be hard to say. Boxes Love Boxing Gloves. It's a game about boxing gloves that come out of boxes. And so a lot of Alan's games, he made Soccer Bond and A Good Snowman is Hard to Build and a bunch of others. And a lot of them are based on pushing blocks around, basically. And the twist in this one, as his description on his website says, in Soviet soccer ban, blocks push you. And the blocks, like every crate basically has one direction from which it will project a boxing glove. And if you walk up to it from that direction, it'll just punch you away. And if that like direction, there's just like one free tile and then there's a wall and you walk into that gap, it'll punch you into the wall and kill you. And if there's two that have their boxing directions pointing each other and you walk between them, they'll punch you and kill you. But if you if it's freestanding, it might punch you and push yourself back. And other than that, you can just push them around normally. And so the way it ends up working is that those boxes are like things that you can push in any direction except the one that their boxing glove comes out of. Like if there's a kind of crate that its boxing direction is down, you're never going to be able to push that one up. You can push it down because you can get to the up of it and then you can push it from behind and it can't do anything to you.
What if you push a box with a boxing glove facing down into a wall that's down?
It doesn't... Below it. You push it into the wall and then it's stuck.
Okay, so it doesn't punch its way off the wall.
It can't push itself away. The strength of the punch is a really nuanced thing. There are so many little implications about that rule. There's like, if it punches you, but it can move back, it will move back. But if it punches you and then the other thing punching you is another box, it will kill you. There are situations where you can like use one box to punch another away. And then there are other situations where like, you can push this box in front of another box and it's going to punch it, but when you do it, instead of pushing itself back, it's going to push your box back. And so what you need to do is brace your box with the second box, and if when this third box punches those two boxes, those two are like flush with each other, it's going to push itself back instead of pushing them back. And I'm on a level where I know that's the key to it, and I can't figure it out. It's this thing where like there's two chambers, and you start on the top left and you're trying to get to an exit in the right-hand chamber, and the connection between the two chambers is just one corridor at the very bottom of the screen. And in the other chamber is a bunch of boxes that are set up as a total death trap. You can't walk through it. They're just going to kill you. And the only way I can see to get those boxes out of the way is to get an up box in there, i.e. a box that punches upwards. But the only box that punches upwards is really high up in the left-hand right. chamber. So I have to push it down by like 8 tiles or something. And I can push it down by like 1 or 2 by placing other boxes in front of it so it pushes itself down, and other tricks like that. But I'm just in a situation where like the only way it can be done is if I have a down box above it. And if a down box is above it, I can push it that down and then it will punch up at me, but I don't care because it's gonna they're going to punch against each other and they're both going to move and it will move down. But they
Presumably it's not against a wall at the top, so it's not punching you.
No, exactly, yeah. Right. And that's one of the ways I know I fucked up is when I'm messing around with this and I realize, oh, it's against a wall now. Yeah. And I'm never going to be able to get it out of that situation. And there are other situations that look impossible, and in another Sokoban game, they would be impossible, like a creep-pushing game. And then you realize, oh, but because they can punch, there's a way to get these things to punch each other in a way that will come out of that impossible situation. But, so, like, I need to get the down box above the up box, and of course, the way the level starts is the down box is below the up box, and it's very hard to move them vertically in any direction. And I can't quite figure it out. But this is, like, level 7 of, like, 28. And every level has seemed impossible. Every level has been one of those things where you just think, what? That can't be done. Fuck off. And then eventually you figure it out. And this one, I don't know if it's going to be doable.
Alan, is this a free thing?
Yeah. Yeah, it's just web-based. So Alan Hazelton has a Patreon, which you can back to support him, which I do. And he really, like, almost all of his games are puzzle script games that involve pushing things around. Puzzle script games always run in your browser. They're very simple graphically. You always know how to play them because the controls are the same. You can always undo infinitely. So every time you make a mistake, you can always go back to wherever the last point you hadn't fucked up was. And yeah, they're free. So that's cool.
Should have called it Super Box Punch, though.
He really likes rhyming names or names where there's like, he did a game about, which I think I've talked about on this podcast, about skipping stones. That push lily pads around, and it's called Skipping Stones to Lonely Homes. And then there's one called You're Pulleying My Leg because it features pulleys.
See, that's a great name. Can't argue with that at all.
And then actually, so he just updated his games page to kind of give you like a guided tour of the things he's made and the most accessible things, and he orders them from easiest to hardest.
Oh, that's such a good idea.
Boxing Gloves game is one of his hardest. But it reminded me that he made a game that I covered for PC Gamer years and years ago before I really knew who he was, called Brick Smash Smash, which is the word Brick Smash contained within the word Brick Smash. And it's a breakout game in which every brick also contains a game of breakout.
I remember that. I didn't realize that was Hazelden. That's
and awesome. Yeah, and so you are playing breakout, and every time your ball hits a brick, it spawns a ball in the breakout game that's going on inside that brick. And you only control it with the mouse, just left and right, but it controls all of the paddles inside all of the bricks. And so for 90% of the bricks, it doesn't matter because there's no balls in them. But as soon as you hit one, there's a ball in there now, and it will hit a brick within the brick, and that's fine. But if you want it to hit more, you've got to move the paddles in such a way that you both catch the ball in the larger game and catch the ball in the mini game. And then, it was actually clever than I realized when I first covered it, because obviously you can hit a brick twice, right? There could be a ball already in play and you're successfully keeping it in play, and then you hit it again with the ball in the big game and it spawns another ball in the little game. You're spawning like 3 balls for yourself. And then obviously it's very hard to keep those balls going. But then if you actually destroy all of the bricks within the brick, that's when the brick in the big game gets properly destroyed, goes away.
Yeah.
And that's your ultimate objective, is to destroy all the bricks that way. So basically you've got to complete every game breakout that's going on inside the games of breakout.
Reminds me of like a good version of Inside Starfield Sky.
Yeah. So, but then the quirk of it is that, so you, the number of balls you have in play within a brick is variable depending on how well you're doing and how many times you've hit it and how well you've kept up those balls. And then when you break it, those balls come out into the bigger game. So if you've got three balls in play, you get 3 balls in play in the big game. And so it's always one, because you've always, at the moment you break the last brick within the brick, you've always got one ball in play because there must be one to break it, right? So you always get a free ball for breaking a brick. But if you play your cards right, you can get like three free balls for breaking a brick. And then it's like, because now you've got to catch three balls in the big game, but also every little ball in all of the other bricks that you've hit. And if a ball in the big game gets above all the bricks and bounces up and down on them, every time it's hitting any one of those bricks, it's spawning a free ball in those. And you're playing like those 17 games of breakout all at once.
How does this not descend to you just scrubbing the mouse back and forth and hoping for the best?
It does. It quickly gets chaotic because the better you do, the more balls spawn, and therefore, like, the more there is to think about, but also the less it matters whether you really get it right. You can drop seven balls at once instead of nine balls in play, and it just kind of snowballs to the point that it's almost solves itself. But that's kind of satisfying. Like, it's you know, difficult early on, and then you're careful and you're careful, and then eventually you don't need to be careful, and it's all just a chaotic mess of balls going bloop.
It's quite unlike a lot of his other games in that regard. It's not about precision and planning at all, but about...
Not methodical. It's just a...
Probably the one I would play the most.
Yeah. I'll start with that one.
Let's do questions. From questions, why not? I normally frame that as a question itself, but I didn't because I forgot.
It's really not an uncertainty.
No, it's not.
We're going to do it. Craig Gates writes, "Dear Great Pun Tryhards, in my day job as a games programmer, I tend to spend a lot of time arguing vehemently in favor of minimalistic and streamlined design. Despite this, when I get home and start working on my own project, I invariably become lost in a wave of grand, overly ambitious ideas that are wholly inappropriate for my team size of one. Are there any games that you feel fail because of over-ambitiousness in particular? Or conversely, are there any where you think unrealistic aims actually contributed significantly to its success? Keep up the great work. You may all have copies of my MMO, BA, FPS, RTS, RPG once it's finished. It's going to be rad." I don't know what the BA is.
MMOBA.
Oh, right, I see.
I was just thinking that as you said it, and then I figured it out.
It's not such a thing now, but like when Morrowind was the latest game in the Elder Scrolls series, and I guess, I can't remember what the exact dates were, I guess like World of Warcraft and Oblivion were similar times, but I remember like I was on PC Gamer with Tim Edwards, I think, who was not editor at that time, and every year there'd be the top 100 discussion, and I always found myself on the kind of like ambitious but slightly shonky games side of the argument, and Tim was always on the like super polished side of the argument, and so he was usually arguing for a Blizzard game or something that was just like whatever it set out to do, it just did it perfectly and beautifully polished, totally understood its own thing. And I was always arguing for stuff like Morrowind, where it was attempting a huge and ridiculous ambitious thing, and a lot of different things about it were shonky. If you picked the wrong class, you were just going to get screwed. I remember like the first mage and the first cave in Morrowind would just kick your ass if you didn't have your build like down perfectly. But they would always lead to these incredible like stories, or there would always be amazing possibilities that you could do within them. And so the fact that like it was totally possible for that game to kick your ass or to reject you basically didn't detract from it if there was a way to get that cool experience out of it for me. And I think, like, the course that the Elder Scrolls series has taken since then is a pretty good argument for doing that kind of design, because they started out shonky and then they just removed the shonkiness a little bit more with each iteration. And now Skyrim is, like, not just a brilliant game, but, like, a massively super popular game. It's still, like, one of the best sellers on Steam every day since it was released.
It's interesting this week in particular, because Mirror's Edge 2 has just come out, or Mirror's Edge Catalyst. And I don't think any of us have played it.
No, I tried to play it before this podcast, and because Graham is playing at the moment, and he said that he was able to like pretend to be in America in order to, because it's not technically unlocked. By the time you hear this podcast, it will be unlocked.
Right.
But yeah, it's like it's out today. Like, it's already out in America, but it's here in England, probably. It's out tomorrow at 11 p.m. Like, what the fuck? It's like 2 days later, okay. The middle of the night. Well, not the middle of the night, but late enough that it's going to be annoying to play it. But I wasn't able to do the same thing. But yeah, that sounds like a game where they didn't learn anything from the feedback.
I was talking to editor of PC Gamer, Sam Roberts, about this. And he was saying that there are basically like two or three close combat sequences in that game that brought the score way down. Because they make you endure it. and they it's just a forced period of boredom that just simply you can't give the game the same score because it's just literally forced you to go and go through a shitty period.
It's so that was true of the original, and it was just so unanimous. Nobody liked the forced combat sections. Even people I'm a bit of an apologist for the fact that there is combat in it at all. I'm not one of the people who thinks it should be removed. I think it should be improved and tweaked and stuff. Mm. But the bits where the way you progress is to turn a really slow moving valve, therefore you have to defeat all enemies in the area before there's any way to progress. Mm. Obviously that's bullshit. It's terrible. And if you're only going to do it you know, this is clearly a thing that people hate. They have done it anyway. And they've done it, three times in the course of the game. If their argument is that it's, super essential and core to the game for some reason, which I can't imagine why it would be, that can't be true if you only have to do it three times in the whole game, right? If it's core to the game, it'd be a regular thing. And if you only have to do it three times, just cut those three times.
Yeah, I think that's a kind of... There's a difference between ambition and bloat, where if you're trying to swell a game with certain... I'm not saying that Mirror's Edge this at all, actually, but as a separate thing, that I think there's a lot of bloat that extends games beyond their natural lifespan, where actually I'd much rather they got rid of the fetch quests and all the quests that aren't interesting in this RPG, for example, and just made it a much purer, more guided experience, more direct experience, especially if it's not a sandbox game. I think there are a lot of non-sandbox games where... they try and artificially create extra padding and extra time sinks where that does dilute the experience, and that I'd score that game lower for wasting people's time, frankly.
I should not rant about Mirror's Edge Catalyst before I've played it, because I'm sure I'm going to be talking about it next week after having actually played it.
Certainly.
And I'm still excited about it. I paid £50 for it.
I mean, I've heard it. I mean, I'm definitely going to play it. I mean, it sounds like a gorgeous, beautiful, free-running game, interrupted by occasional moments of bastardry.
Noel Warford writes, hello, Quatian Crowbarians. I have recently been reading the entire Discord series in honour of Sir Terry Pratchett's untimely passing last year, and I was considering my favourite of the three, going postal, making money, and raising steam. These three books star Moist van Lipwig, a con artist extraordinaire who gets press ganged into making government offices more efficient with smiles and half-truths. This led to me wishing that there was a game in which you play as such a con artist, but that would probably be impossible. I can't really think of a way to simulate the intricate personal relationships and manipulation to make a con happen in the game, though I may be missing a great example of this somewhere. My question is, which work of fiction would you love to see in a game, but it's probably impossible to implement with minimal ludonarrative dissonance? Drink. due to its structure or some other factor. Thanks and happy podding, Noel.
Oh, I've got a drink now.
Drink.
Yeah.
Oh, shit, sorry. Yep.
I don't really have an answer to this question, but I sort of I preferred the question I thought it was leading towards, which was how would you make a game about a con artist? And I think he's probably right that it's impossible to make that with just AI. And, once upon a time, I might have said, oh, well, it's just too hard to write an AI that would convincingly be, seem intelligent and yet be fooled by your antics. But actually, I don't think that's it. I think you could probably write a Turing complete AI for certain games where it's impossible to tell that it's not a human in terms of the way it behaves. But if you know it's not a human, it's not as satisfying to beat. There are games where the bots are just, I wouldn't know they weren't human. But if I do know they're not human, I don't enjoy playing against them, or my victories are not as sweet. There are plenty of games where I can defeat the bots reliably, and but the fact that they're robots means I don't care. Whereas if I play 7 games in a row and I win every single one really easily, it never gets old. I'm just I'm so pleased with myself, and it's awesome that I'm winning if I know they're humans. And I suspect it's the same with trickery. I can play the spy against bots in TF2 in their robot invasion mode thing, I guess. But I don't think there's any pleasure to kind of deceiving an AI, really.
I think at the point of the con, literature, and television works really, really, really hard to make the victim of the con evil in some way or morally wrong, because the actual act of conning someone in the moment is fucking horrible.
Yep.
you're really, it's the lying at its most extreme kind of application, and turning that into entertainment is kind of going to be very, very hard.
There is a game that is spectacularly about conning people, and it's called Eve.
That's true.
Host to some of the most spectacular instances of cons. I mean, the thing is, I think the reason this is a tricky problem to solve is you can't really do it against AI for reasons detailed. That would be gratifying. And if you do it against people, it's not a game. You've just conned them. Con is essentially like, it's essentially like violence done to language in purpose of your own gain, right? Like, or violence done to the truth. And that is as much the case whether you're doing it to ruin a corporation in Eve or if you're doing it in real life, quote unquote.
I mean, this is like why I got so enraptured with a spy in TF2 was... This didn't hold true for every like game that you played as him, but like when it worked, its highs were much higher and its lows are much lower than other classes because it felt like you were lying to people. It felt like you were like, if you, on the rare occasion, this got rarer and rarer as TF2 went on, but in the early days, like wearing a disguise could sometimes actually fool people into thinking you were on their team and you could actually make them trust you for a while and you could get healed by their medics and stuff like that. And then when you eventually betray them, the sort of like the adrenaline as you're doing that is so much higher for the fact that, you know, they believed you and you were getting away with it. And when you get caught, the fact that you got caught is shameful. Like when I'm playing a soldier and someone just headshots me, there's no shame. I'm annoyed. Maybe I hate them. Maybe I don't. But in no way do I feel like, you know, remorseful for my actions or anything. But then as a spy, when you're trying to pretend to be someone and they just see straight through it and they set fire to you, you're kind of like, oh, fuck, that's embarrassing.
But I guess you wouldn't necessarily create a game all about conning actual people because hopefully that wouldn't necessarily be appealing to a lot of people.
I mean, so actually one thing I wanted to mention was the game Ruse, which is an RTS very much about deception, where you could do things like deploy like a fake unit where it looked to the enemy exactly like a real unit, but it actually had no hit points or attack value. And if they got to it, then they could... discover that, and had very like each one of those was like a ruse card, I think, and there were all kinds of different ones you could play. I seem to remember I never played it myself really. I might have played like a beta at a preview event or something, but I never played it once it was out, and didn't get great reviews, so I guess it didn't pull that off to the extent that it hoped. Aidan McGlennon asked a question that basically we already answered, but I just thought I'd mention it. He wants to know about games that do a good job of letting you communicate without speaking or typing. And I already talked about Way and Journey on this podcast. Those are my choices.
Dark Souls.
So he mentioned
Gesture System.
Dark Souls, Hearthstone, and Diablo. I haven't played Hearthstone, but I like the principle of a game that just stops you from talking, like just says, no, sorry, the only thing you're allowed to do is just say, like, thank you or well done. Hugh Briss writes, I get it. I didn't get it until I said it out loud. I happily discovered your podcast just this week, and I'm happy I did. As you already said, you make 8 hours at work go by in a flash. Anyways, I played Stardew Valley right as it came out and spent a fair amount of time with it. As I got further in the game, I realized my experience with it is probably quite different than everyone else's. In reading various reviews and the subreddit dedicated to the game, I noticed that many people are very enchanted with the social aspect of the game that makes you play into it with its NPCs. I, on the other hand, have barely interacted with the majority of the NPCs except for Linus, the game's hermit character, for lack of a better term. And the fact that I felt the most affinity for the game's single loner NPC is probably telling in its own right. Long story short, Stardew Valley made me have a personal realization about myself that I am essentially antisocial at this point due to a variety of reasons, including two tragedies that I'll probably be working through the rest of my life. So my question for you guys is, has a game ever prompted a meaningful self-realization / epiphany, positive or negative, for you? Keep up the good work. I look forward to continuing to listen. Kind of love that the hermit character is called Linus.
It's a peanut.
I imagine that he invented Linux.
Oh, wait.
This rang a bell in that it isn't really the same kind of revelation, but playing Fahrenheit, discovering that like
there were certain like relationships in that game that I thought were just like closed off to you, and then finding out that other people made those relationships work, I'm sort of like, oh fuck, I'm just bad at relationships.
I'm not sure if that's necessarily the skill that Fahrenheit is measuring in that exact scenario.
Yeah, and if it is, it's probably not an accurate measurement of your real ability to maintain relationships.
You are, yeah, you're certainly bad at relationships, as David Cage anticipates how they play out, because it involves quite a lot of quick time events.
You mean to say that could be different to reality?
I am saying that, Tom, yeah. I don't know, I feel like I've talked way too much, even on this podcast, about the various personal revelations I've experienced by being competitive in various contexts in games.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, I only wrote about 70 columns about that.
I think it's...
Yeah. But that's still true.
It's strange that, like, his story doesn't strike me as sad. Like, it seems quite a nice thing that there's, you know, play this game and had fun with it, and then just found out that the way other people were having fun with it is different. But he still was able to have fun with it in his own
way. Yeah, it's nice. Yeah, it's a testament to the breadth of the game, I guess.
Yeah, definitely.
I'd be kind of interested to know whether, like, knowing that made him want to interact with NPCs, or whether he's just happy enjoying it the way he already did. Because I sort of suspect the latter, and that seems fine to me. Claudia Lowe writes, "Dear Quote and Crowbar, what do you think is the place of academia in gaming right now? What do you think it could be in the future? I'm mostly thinking about academia in relation to games criticism, but there are also plenty of developers who are academics or ex-academics. I know that there is some really good work coming out of all sorts of developments and fields relating to video games, e.g. English literature, sociology, and media studies, and there's a definite interest in gamification and the like as something to study, but I wanted to know if you had any thoughts on the topic. Thanks." Our good friend Mike Cook is an academic who is also an indie developer, and he's sort of like a great... middleman sounds like a negative term. He's a great person who has both skill and knowledge of both sides, and can tell both sides what they can gain from each other. And I really despise talking to him about like his work that he's, you know, I knew he'd worked on like a procedural generation tool that is kind of like, you can plug it into your game, and like if you have a way of generating levels, a common problem of procedural generation is like you kind of know what roughly you want to generate, and then you've got to write an algorithm that does that. And there are so many variables of like, you know, if you're trying to generate like a Spelunky type level, maybe one of the variables is like, how dense do you want it to be? What percentage of land versus empty space do you want? How many enemies do you want per tile, and that kind of thing. And Mike has made a tool that if you can plug your procedural generator into it, you can actually just tell it what you want, what the end goal is. Like, I want it to be this much land and this much empty space, or this many enemies and this, or these properties, whatever it is you can define about the levels. And it will find a way to reorganize your algorithm so that it does generate those generally. And you can even like tweak the distribution. So like, I want that most of the time, but like 20% of the time, I want it to be totally nuts and out of that field. And the thing that surprised me about that was that like, that's, academia is sort of actively trying to come up with tools that will help like indie developers and stuff. Like, you can get funding for that because it will help indie developers. Like, that's a thing that exists.
It's really, really interesting. I'd welcome any like critical academic looks at video games. Like, it'd be amazing if academia looked at video games more critically than it maybe does. You know, instead of that, I think that there's a huge amount of value that video game systems have to offer to academics that they are clearly experimenting with. So, for example, there's something called nudge theory, which is about like how to, as a political aspiration, to steer people into behaving better in ways that are better for themselves. So, for example, if you want organ donors, then everyone to be organ donors, then you enroll in, you inform everyone that they're going to be enrolled into an organ donor program, but they're auto-enrolled, and it requires an effort to unenroll themselves. And to me, that feels like a game system that's kind of being applied onto a populace. And there's loads of stuff involved with nudge theory that kind of looks at what games do all the time to get people to keep playing free-to-play games and that kind of thing, then applies it into a social situation in order to control behavior. Incentivize behavior, let's say. And incentivization is the main thing in that, where like people know the choice they're making and know what options they have, but it's easier for them to go down one route than down another. And the other example of this in terms of video games, which game systems for academia, is about simulating population behaviors or just creating simulation environments where you can test things in the simulation environment. And I'm sure this happens a lot already with current technology, but it leads to there's a brilliant thing called the simming effect or the simulation effect, which has been identified in Banks's books, where the simulation is so accurate that it becomes philosophically interesting to differentiate the simulation from the actual people that you're simulating. So you create a society that, and the simulation is so detailed and so accurate that that's essentially a functioning society. And if you delete it, are you deleting the society that of actual beings you've created? Right. And it's worth Googling the simming problem that Ian M. Banks has encountered in his culture novels, because it's very interesting. And I think you probably touched on those issues with your degree, Tom, when you were talking, you wrote a dissertation on teleportation and
cloning people. Yeah.
It's like, when does a simulacrum of a person become?
Yeah, it gets very tricky. Like if all of your personality and consciousness and all the value that you have as a human being can be replicated, then if you replicate it and then destroy the replica, for all intents and purposes, it seems like nothing has happened. If you replicate it and destroy the original, people get very uppity about that. They seem to take issue with that. And yet, in many, if we accept the premise that it is possible to replicate a person perfectly, then there's no difference between that and the destroying a replica.
Yeah. And I was thinking about, I talked on the podcast months ago about Universe 25 or 26, the mouse universe.
Mm.
And I'm dead keen to recreate it in Game Maker.
I'm just stressed that. It was a society of mice created in a control test environment, not the mouse universe, no. Which is where humans are mice.
No, this is a universe where a limited number of mice are trapped in a universe with certain, amounts of food and access to sex and, et cetera, et cetera. And the way that society, collapses. And you could, in Game Maker, you could just create loads of behaviours for a load of different individuals and then watch them interact. And it was like a toy. You just press go on it and then you change the amounts of food and stuff. I might build that. That'd be really fun.
Yeah. The Game of Life. Conway's Game of Life, which is like one of the oldest kind of game-like simulations. It's not really a game because it's not interactive, but it is just a set of rules. And you have cells that are either filled or not. And every kind of tick, every turn, there are rules about, like, if a cell is surrounded by more than three things and it's filled, then it will go empty. Or if it's surrounded by more than X number of empty cells, it will go full. And I can't remember what the rules are, but the rules are very simple. And it leads to just sort of endless complexity that is incredibly hard to predict and incredibly hard to kind of make general theorems about and prove things about. And one form of it's called the Game of Life because you can create a pattern in it which will perpetuate forever. Like it will keep reproducing itself, or it will just move itself, kind of like bits of it will die and bits of it will appear on the other side in such a way that it basically moves across the screen. Those are called spaceships. And just in the last like month or so, someone discovered a new spaceship. Like, there are only a certain number of known patterns that will endlessly perpetuate themselves. And someone discovered a new one that's, like, not that big. It's, like, I don't know, I want to say it's, like, 16 pixels or something. And just no one had ever tried that particular combination. No one knew that it could self-perpetuate. And it's a discovery of sorts. I feel like it's probably more of academic interest than game interest. But it was just like, it was really interesting because there's a forum where people discuss these things. It's really interesting to read the thread where someone posts this and says, like, I don't know, like, this doesn't seem to terminate. Can anyone find if there's a bug in the simulation software I'm using? And then just like, everyone's response is like, you found a new one. Oh my God, how did you find this? What?
Don't kill it. It's real. It's life.
Rachel writes, I have Warcraft on the mind. If Blizzard made a Warcraft 4, what would you like to see from it?
So talk about the RTS, like an
yeah,
RTS sequel.
So like the last one was Warcraft 3, which I really enjoyed. And I've enjoyed a lot of their StarCraft stuff as well. I've always had a bit of a complaint about the StarCraft stuff where like they put a huge amount of effort into it and they make it very tailored to single player, like because it obviously
StarCraft is a huge esport. I imagine if they made a Warcraft 4, it would also be a huge esport, and they would probably want to focus on that to some extent. But they've been pretty good about like just recognizing that single player is a totally different issue, and you just need to make a whole different game for that. And they have, and they've put all the money and effort into that. The only thing I don't really love about the StarCraft single player stuff is that it's so unique and so handcrafted that just every mission is its own little script and its own little thing, where it's just like, on this mission you must use this unit to do this, and on this mission you must do this, and it's always like a special case, and you never really get to just like build your base and take and build an army and then go crush the enemy base. And there'll be like elements of that in some of those missions, but every time I play one of those StarCraft campaigns, I end up just wishing, like, I just want to just give me a base and kind of give them a base. Yeah, but I kind of want that, but with structure. Like, a lot of my favorite RTS experiences were with Dawn of War expansions, which did exactly that, where it was literally just the skirmish mode repackaged with a campaign map, and they put all their effort on the campaign map and making all the new units and stuff. And the skirmishes themselves would be on these absurdly artificial, like perfectly rotationally symmetric maps that are just pulled from the multiplayer and the skirmish mode. And it would make no sense at all that you're fighting in this weirdly orchestrated place. But it was just really satisfying to like build up your sort of honor guard units that you bring to each map, and then figure out the best way to crush this opponent as fast as possible and play a really good skirmish game, and then be told, for that, you got rewarded with this cool new unit that will come with you to all the next missions.
It'd be really interesting to watch them, like how they would create heroes in a post-HOTS, post-Diablo 3 world.
Because
they could actually, you know, bring a lot of that expertise into like Warcraft heroes.
And I guess like Warcraft 3 started all this, right? It was the RTS that had heroes who had RPG type properties.
Yeah.
You could level up and they had items and all this stuff. And then that led to Dota.
And imagine like a campaign or that focuses more on that than almost the esports kind of army balance side of things.
Well, to be honest, like, I mean, you say that a Warcraft game would necessarily have an esports component. It doesn't have to. Like, StarCraft was bound in its competitive... Like, StarCraft was bound to have this hard division between esports and single player because StarCraft Brood War had had basically created esports on a scale that had never been achieved by any other game. And so, of course, the sequel had to very, very closely mirror it.
Mm.
Had to be basically the same game, but with many tweaks. Like, you know, I mean, obviously it was a new game, but it was also slavishly faithful to the original. Like, while Warcraft 3 did have a successful competitive scene to an extent, it, you know, the spectacular success of Warcraft 3's multiplayer were MOBAs, the invention of that entire genre. So I don't think, actually, that a potential Warcraft 4 is in any way beholden to be an esport. In the same sense. Like, I think if Blizzard... And I think this is the opportunity for Blizzard. Like, if they make it, this is an opportunity for them to make a more fun, competitive RTS than StarCraft really is. Because StarCraft is an incredibly punishing game.
Mm.
It's beautiful, and it's dazzlingly complex, and it's probably the hardest competitive game in the world. Like, it's, you know, it, like, the best players of StarCraft are juggling more factors at once, including manual skill and thought and everything, than any other player of any other game, I think, really, at that level. And but Warcraft doesn't have to be that at all, I don't think. Like, I sort of would want Warcraft 4 to be the Hearthstone of StarCraft. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make sense, yeah. Like, as Magic the Gathering is to StarCraft, is as Warcraft is to...
So no,
here's the gin. As Magic the Gathering is to Hearthstone,
StarCraft is to Warcraft.
It's to Warcraft.
Yeah,
got there eventually.
Yeah,
I follow exactly.
That'd be what I would want.
Yeah,
be amazing. That sounds good to me. Joel Olson writes, "Hi, when I play Elite Dangerous, I loudly mimic the hyper jump countdown and make hand gestures when it says engage. I make this nerdy gang sign and browse engage like the N-gage, emphasis on the N. What's wrong with me?"
Nothing important.
Yeah,
nothing that matters.
I mean, just like,
we'd read that out, really.
If a game lets you say engaged in order to like actually go into a hyper jump, you've got to say it out loud, right? You can't just let the game say it for you.
I mean, you don't have to say that in Elite.
I don't mean you literally have to say it loud, but I mean,
you should. Yeah. I'm surprised he goes for N-gage as in the defunct Nokia game platform and not engage in the manner of Jean-Luc Picard.
Yeah, I guess you say it enough, it corrupts itself to the Nokia side of things.
How do you pronounce that differently to the phrase engage anyway?
Engage.
Engage.
I think, yeah.
Engage.
Okay, so I'll just say them both. Engage. Engage.
Engage. Engage.
I feel like Picard. This has
become the worst.
Picard puts more emphasis on the second syllable. Like, engage.
Engage. Whereas, yeah, no, it is, yes.
I want to hear Patrick Stewart say the engage. The
we
Nokia
should probably
engage.
Just like slot this into the podcast and the editing process. Just compare the, you know.
If we can get him to do it.
Engage from Nokia. Captain Picard said.
Number one, bring me my N-gauge.
just the Enterprise cruising through space identifying failed game platform launches by mobile phone manufacturers. Now that Motorola one.
Perhaps. That's all the questions we care about this week. And you can send us questions at questions@crateandcrowbar.com. You can post them on our forum, which is crateandcrowbar.com/forum. You can tweet them at us. We are @CrateandCrowbar on Twitter. And you can also follow us individually on Twitter. I am @Pentadact, PENTADACT. Tom S., what are you?
I'm @PCGLudo, LUDO.
Chris T., what are you?
Christy, I am @CThurston, CTHURSTEN, Gage.
Thanks for listening, everybody!
Quality gin.